Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we kick things off with local and national politics. From the fate of the marijuana bill at the State House to the fate of the Democratic Party, which seems to hinge on a special election in Georgia. And along the way, President Trump is contradicting his own lawyer about whether he's being investigated by the FBI. Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chipio join us for that and more. From there, it's on to global affairs with Charlie Sennett and the latest on what looks to be another terror attack in London. At noon, we're opening the lines and asking you if we should be keeping up with the Alex Joneses. Did Megyn Kelly's interview last night expose him or promote him?
And I'm Jared Bowen, and for Jim Browdy, while global events make it feel like the center isn't holding, does it at least hold on the new season of the Great British Baking Show? Or, like everything else, the baked Alaskas and chocolate souffles, well, they collapse. We'll get TV expert Bob Thompson's take on this and other TV news. And we'll talk to the MFA's new director about changing his vision next on Boston Public Radio.
I am Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy has the day off, and Jared Bowen, executive editor of the arts department here. I got that wrong. WGBH executive arts editor. That's the correct title, correct, Jared?
That's
Bowen?
Right. That's right.
Thank you for being here.
Great to be here. I see you. I'm looking out the window here at GBH, and I see this tall man in a baseball cap and sunglasses. I see you, Jim Browdy. I see you out there.
He's spying on us, do you think? Okay. Okay. So we've all heard of the Twinkie defense. Now, Trump's lawyer is using the tweeting defense, saying that his client in chief is not under investigation for obstruction, even though the president himself tweeted last week that he is being investigated. Trump's lawyer was on all the talk shows yesterday, says the president's tweet was not accurate because he is limited to only 140 characters. Maybe pointing out Trump's limited characters, not something his lawyer should be doing. Joining us to take on these and other headlines are Charlie Chipio and Shannon O'Brien. Charlie Chipio is principal of Chipio Strategies and senior fellow at both the Governing and Pioneer Institutes. And Shannon O'Brien is former state treasurer and Democratic nominee for governor. Charlie and Shannon, it's great to have you both here. So, Charlie, let me start with you, since you're I forget where you are now. You were a Republican, now you're an independent.
I'm unenrolled because I can't deal with people like Trump.
Okay, you're unenrolled. I'm unenrolled too. But anyway, you know, assuming that that it does look, despite what the president's lawyer says, that that Mueller is looking at the president for possible obstruction of justice. So, assuming that the president does not fire Mueller, what does this mean for the Trump administration going forward? Congress seems to be able to do stuff despite this investigation. I don't know what it means for Trump. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it means a few things. I think certainly Congress may be able to do stuff, but certainly Trump's legislative agenda doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And, of course, part of the reason that his legislative agenda isn't going anywhere is that we get these occasional sort of two-page bullet point things, but we don't get any actual legislation that's being filed. So I think clearly what it's going to mean for Trump, in addition to this seemingly sort of growing political crisis, you have a situation where you're going to have more and more of these top jobs not being filled. Fewer and fewer people wanting to enter into this madness. And that means that any sort of legislative program that he has is going to continue to be stalled because there's no one there to put it together.
Well, yeah, Shannon, you have to wonder how, I mean, you've managed an executive office, how they're even managing today when they seem to be in constant catch-up mode with crisis. You know, to Charlie's point, how do you get beyond that two-page summary when you're spending most of your time trying to get out in front of stories when you're really behind them, it seems, these days?
Well, there's no leadership right now. And when it comes to a legislative agenda, you know, never mind the lack of ability to get stuff done, like in different consulates and different offices and different administrative positions that have to get the job done. I mean, I was speaking to someone who took a trip down to Washington last week who had to deal with the Department of Defense. And they just are looking at, you know, my friend and saying, we have not known what to do for months. We literally don't know what to do. But the legislative agenda, as Charlie was referencing just last week, as the, you know, the alternative to Obamacare, you know, moves through both the House and the Senate, and Trump is criticizing the House bill as very mean piece of legislation. I mean, he undercuts his own party's legislative team trying to move his ball forward,
in
even
his
though
own comments, in his own past comments.
And yeah. Right. So it's stunning.
Well, that's an important thing, though. because if the president thinks that what the House did is mean, and as people may know, the Senate is meeting in secrecy, and they're taking a lot of flack for meeting in secrecy to get this new proposed health care bill through. If the president says it's mean, that matters a little bit, doesn't it? Or doesn't it?
Well, I think it depends. Are we talking about the pre-Trump world or the post-Trump world? I would think in the pre-Trump world, if the president came out and said that a legislative proposal put forth by his own party was mean, that would have a large impact. I think that you get to a point where almost nothing he says can have any impact because every day he says things that are seemingly crazy.
Isn't that an ad? Isn't that a good Democratic ad? And the president says the bill is mean.
I think there's a couple out there right now. but right now, you know, they own health care. They can blame Obama all they want right now. They can blame the Democratic legislature for, you know, having, passed a bill in secret, which included 161 Republican amendments, I might add. But the fact is they now own it. Even if they do nothing, I think that the public has been tuned in enough to the process and tuned in enough to what Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act really was, that they will understand that when they start seeing their premiums go up, when they start losing even more health care exchanges, because insurance companies are rudderless right now, they don't know where the law is going to go, they don't know what the subsidies are going to be, so many of them are pulling out. You know, people are a lot more tuned in. Maybe it's good for United States civics understanding that people know what the name of their vice president is and they know who the, security team is. But the fact is they also know a lot more about policy right now because it's been hammered home in front of them. And whether or not they pass a new bill, Donald Trump and his team and the Republicans are going to own this right now.
Yeah. And the bottom line is, no matter what you think about Obamacare, you know, they have had 8 years to figure out what to do about it and what to change about it. And when the time came, they were sitting there, you know, the emperor had no clothes. They had no idea what to do.
Right. And it's just the overall lack of really wanting to make something concrete happen. I mean, I think the Democrats agree that they made a lot of compromises that made it not a perfect piece of legislation. And a lot of things need to still be fixed. You know, it's a huge, what do they say, 1/6 of the economy. And so the first swipe at something like that massive change is going to need constant improvements. It's too bad that they can't get together and make some positive improvements so that we don't have a mean piece of legislation that works for everyone.
Well, going back to the investigation for a moment, and we know that the president has this core constituency that still gives him high approval ratings, still has faith in him as president. And I was listening to some of the conversation about him over the weekend, looking at the tweets. How successful do you think he is in engendering sympathy by waging this argument that he is under attack, that he is subject to a witch hunt?
I think it works. I mean, there are still people out there who believe Pizzagate, that Hillary Clinton was running a sex ring in a pizza shop in Washington, D.C. I mean, people still believe
Everybody
that.
Knows that was really Bill.
Yeah.
that would have been more believable. Yeah.
Would you like pepperoni?
Exactly.
That was awful. Yeah. But anyway, but there are still people out there. You know, I go on to, when I can't sleep at night, I've confided this before. You know, I go on Twitter and I sort of look around at different articles. And it is stunning to me when you read the subtweets and the commentary, what people really believe. And it really is a function of, you know, the splintering and the siloization of our media right now and the sort of sharing of intelligence and political thought. People, when you get up every day and you read the same sources that reinforce what you believe, you're going to keep believing that.
Well, you know, it's very – I thought the Washington Post had a great piece over the weekend going out, again, talking with Trump voters and non-Trump voters in some of these same rural areas. And it showed exactly that. There were perceptions about Pizzagate and kind of these crazy things. But also there was a real – sense, and you see this in Massachusetts when there's fights about welfare, this group of people that are really struggling, and they are not on welfare, but they're close to being on welfare, and they're driven crazy by the idea that their next door neighbor is getting all these free things that they're not, and that's transferred now onto people who are here illegally in the country.
Well, I give you I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'll give you a firsthand example of that. Some of the folks who work at Pioneer, where I'm a senior fellow, I walked in there one day, and like me, they have relatively young kids, and like me, they are essentially taking their paychecks and handing them over to orthodontists because all the young kids have braces. And someone there walked in with the little thing that said, if you're on MassHealth, you get free braces. And all of us, we were ready to throw ourselves out the window. You know, I mean,
I don't feel bad for you. I won Keno on New Year's Eve, and that's how I paid for braces. True story.
Really?
McGuigan's Pub in Whitman, big winner, paid for braces.
Just one more thing about this investigation before we move off it. Pence is now, the vice president is getting his own lawyer, and apparently he's going to be paying for it. We're not sure, but we think out of campaign funds. We don't think he's going to be paying for it out of his own pocket. But I remember back to Bill Clinton's impeachment problems in the White House and the different investigations. A lot of the people that work for him lost their shirts paying for lawyers. So I don't know how it works. I guess maybe for the vice president you can get campaign money, or I don't know.
If you're a political figure, and again, I don't know all campaign finance rules now, but it was always perceived that it was campaign accounts are not only to run and win elections, but also can be utilized to enhance your political reputation.
Yeah.
And so this was could be perceived as protecting your political reputation. Right. The problem is, if you're not a political candidate and you don't have, you know, a political fund, you have nothing to defend. So, you know, that is a really difficult thing, that when you're working with someone and you're sort of this, you know, getting strafed, you know, by the incoming, you don't have that ability, you know, unless you have friends who are going to raise you money.
Yeah, like a Sean Spicer or like a Kellyanne Conway.
I already feel barely bad for him.
I do too. I feel really bad for him. But he may have to pony up legal.
Look, and that's another reason why they can't fill these positions. Because who wants to walk into that?
Well, reading the tea leaves, by the way, about Mike Pence, obviously he's going to lawyer up. Everybody is, for all the reasons we just talked about. But he's claiming that there's a lot he didn't know about what was happening with Russia, and he's lawyering up because of the Russia investigation at a time when he was leading the transition, when a lot of these conversations were supposedly taking place. So do we believe that he had nothing to do with it, that he was kept outside?
Yes, I can just see the question now in the Senate hearing. You know, Mr. Pence, was this malfeasance on your part, or are you just an idiot? You know, I can just
poor Pence. I feel bad for him. So there's this,
And then they will yell at Kamala Harris for interrupting him when he tries to answer.
Much was made of that she and Elizabeth Warren were both interrupted in the midst of these hearings.
Well, but just to go back to this point, I mean, I believe it's willful ignorance. And
what, Pence?
Yeah. And you know, when you see that Elijah Cummings, you know, sent a letter to the incoming administration pointing out that Michael Flynn had some problems, this needed to be looked into. He either knew or was not doing his job, because the fact is, the number one job you do is to bring in the best people into the administration, and to not vet these people is you know, it should be a crime, because it hurts not only the administration, but it hurts all of us United States citizens.
We're talking with Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chipio about national politics. After the break, we'll talk about local politics. But I want to ask you about this Georgia special election. People probably know in suburban Atlanta there's a race, this 30-year-old who's got no experience in politics. He's Democrat. John Ossoff is running against Republican Karen Handel. This is normally this is Tom Price. He's now, is he Health and Human Services? Is that his title now?
I think so.
Health and Human Services guy in the Trump cabinet. He won by some 23 points the last time. He's a Republican, obviously. Now the race is supposedly too close to call. Here's my question to you, Democrat Shannon O'Brien. I mean, Ossoff is... Is that how you pronounce it?
Ossoff.
Thank you. Just want to make sure I had that right. He's not a progressive guy. He's a Democrat, and he certainly has much different positions than the Republican, obviously. But Democrats seem to be spending a lot of money on this race, making a big deal out of this race. He doesn't seem to be the most appealing candidate, although he's close with Karen Handel. So if the Democrats win, what happens? If they lose, what happens?
He's not the strongest candidate. And it's amazing, between this race in a seat that should absolutely go to a Republican, that he's leading by a point or half a point or something like that. You know, and in the other two races, in Kansas and, what was it, Montana, these are all seats that should be solidly Republican seats.
Right.
And they're a lot closer than they should be. So it is sending a very strong message about what people are seeing, not only from the leadership within the Trump administration. I think it's a referendum on Trump, but it also is a referendum on the Republican Congress and what we've been talking about, that they are not, you know, if people were mad about Obamacare, do something about it. If your district was mad about that, why aren't you getting something done? You have had all this time to get it done. So I think that it's troubling, and I think especially if he wins, it's going to send some real shivers up the backs of a lot of, you know, Republican Congress people who may be in more purple districts, that they're going to have to be even more concerned about what happens.
It's also
year.
Interesting because this is not like a redneck district. You know, this is not the, district yeah. that it was when Gingrich represented it. It, you know, it's much more it's much a wealthier, more educated Republican district. And it's just interesting because it shows, sort of going back to what we were saying before, that that Trump is not playing with that portion of the Republican Party.
Yeah. Educated.
Well, right.
Somebody had an article this morning, it might have been the Globe, that said that he's not making any, that is Trump, making any effort to move beyond that base, that he's just going back again to the base, traveling to places where he's very popular, addressing people where he's very popular. When he spoke about Cuba, he was speaking in an area of Florida where he knew he would get
He only wants to get a pat on the head.
Yeah,
That's all he wants.
Yeah, I've given up the idea that there's any strategy here. Yeah. He's just like my dog. He just goes where he's going to get adulation and where he's going to get what he wants. You know, I mean, I think that's what it is.
The cabinet meeting where everyone went around the table and said what a great job and how blessed they are, that I think crystallizes the real problem with this administration is that it's really not about moving the ball forward, getting something done. It's convincing this guy that he really is the president and he's really good. The fact is that we just lost seven, you know, sailors, you know, in a tragic, you know, crash in, you know, in Japan, and he's talking about Hillary Clinton still. That there's something wrong with that.
The day after he was inaugurated, he went to the CIA where all these people had died for the country, and he was talking about how big the crowds were at his inauguration. Yeah. You know?
This is a little bit off topic, but I was noticing that 140,000 votes have already been cast in Georgia for the early voting.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
So this is happening. The news is changing on a daily basis. We just saw that happen in Montana. There was early voting there, and then right on the election eve, the congressman got into the scuffle with a reporter. Is it time to reconsider, perhaps, early voting? I've heard people talk about this, whether or not this should still be practiced.
Early voting plays a role, and I understand that people, you know, are concerned when the dynamics change or new information comes out. But, you know, maybe there's some I can come in and take it back. And just like with my I own stock in a small local bank, and I can send in my proxy vote, but then I can go in and vote in person. Maybe there's some sort of hybrid that they could create, something like that.
We're talking with Charlie Chipio and Shannon O'Brien about national politics. We're going to talk to them about local politics. Couple minutes.
That's all coming up next. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you are just tuning in, we're talking politics with Charlie Chipio, principal of Chipio Strategies and senior fellow at both the Governing and Pioneer Institutes, and Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer and Democratic nominee for governor. So, as everybody knows, marijuana was legalized by Massachusetts voters in a ballot question in November. And you know what kind of hit the fan last week, where the House kind of rewrote the pot law. In some ways, I don't know what the right tax should be. They raised the tax up to, I think, 23 or 28%. 28%.
Yeah.
Had been 12%, was it before? But the most egregious thing I think they did was under the ballot question, if you did not want to have a pot dispensary in your town, people had to vote.
Yeah.
And then they changed that to make it so that selectmen could vote, or the if it was a city, the town officials could vote. Now they're backing off this in the Senate. I don't get why they thought in the House that they could get away with this.
Well, I think there's a long history of the legislature getting away with sort of whatever they wanted to do.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the way they handled the pay raise. You know,
that's a good point.
You know, so but yeah, and it's very. And I was very interested. Now, I will admit that I do not follow the pot stuff as closely as you do, Marjorie, but
breathlessly, every move.
But I found it very interesting, but that both the Globe and the Herald editorialized in favor of the House version today.
Portions of it. They were in favor of the taxes.
I guess they pointed
out
that
so many different pieces.
Yeah, that Colorado has the 30%. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that one thing that will not be included from the House is what you just said, the giving the local officials the power to just say, no, we don't want it here.
Yeah. What do you think, Janet?
Well, and if I can defend, you know, this is part of the problem with referendum, and this is one of the things that President Rosenberg was talking about. I forget which issue, you know, the family leave bill, because it is always a threat to the legislature. This will go on the referendum process. It's a very bad way to pass laws. And generally it happens because people get frustrated that the legislature haven't, you know, done something that they want to have done, and so they bring it to the people. But, you know, having been in the legislature, you know, it does take time to read the bills to understand it. Most of the people who are going into the polls, maybe they get that nice little packet from Secretary of State Bill Galvin that explains all the referendum questions.
Great. Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you that more people than not don't read all of the details. It's just, are you for it or are you against it? That's not how you pass detailed pieces of legislation that have an impact on zoning laws and schools and taxes. It's a very, very complex piece of legislation. You know, that being said, you know, I hope that they can, with some prodding from both the referendum people as well as maybe the opinion leaders in the newspapers, that they can come up with something that both taxes it well, which I think needs to be done, but also make sure that towns get their say and that people get their say based on what was passed in the referendum.
Moving on to the upcoming election, the gubernatorial election, and Governor Baker, some are saying, took a big hit last week with questions about how our state revenues are doing, and they're really failing to keep pace with what was projected. There could be a hole of $400 million to $500 million range. Does this open a big weak spot for Governor Baker?
I tell you, I think that he's got a tougher road to hoe than most people think. You know, I think that for a Republican to win in Massachusetts, you got to thread the needle in the first place. I certainly don't think that this. I would not really blame him for this downgrade of the bond rating. But you know, we are in a very difficult situation in Massachusetts. That if we are unable to pay the bills when the economy, in a macro sense, is this good. The next downturn is going to be very ugly. We don't have a ton of money in the rainy day fund, and if that downturn comes in the next year and a half, that's going to create a very difficult situation politically for Governor Baker.
And the legislature and the administration over the course of the last, you know, how many years have cut taxes significantly. We are no longer an outlier in terms of, you know, we still have the reputation of Taxachusetts, but we do not have, you know, the highest tax rates. Now, other things are more expensive, that being said. I point now to Kansas. Conservative state,
oh, yeah.
Republicanly controlled legislature, Republican governor, and they went so far cutting taxes, you know, promoting the trickle-down theory of economics, and they found it created a disaster for that state's economy. And they have overridden
The conservatives, you know, in the legislature are
overriding the governor because they understand you can take this so far, but if you have terrible schools and terrible roads and bridges, you know, and terrible, you know, opportunities for people, you know, you're going to have a terrible state. So I think that Charlie Baker needs to come to grips with this is to be a Republican is not just to be anti-tax. You need to be able to lead as well, maybe a little bit more along the lines of Frank Sargent going back many years, but a Republican who can both understand fiscal conservatism, but also not ridiculousness that it's tax cuts at
and
all.
I think he understands that. I think the problem that he has is that he has got sort of this small band of right-wing Tea Party people who are just making his life miserable within the party to begin with, you know, and in a difficult place.
How's he going to get around this then? Because he's going to get hammered by the Democratic candidates who are already marching out.
Well, that's why he runs and I just talk. you got me. I mean, look, he's going to have to I think he's either going to have to make some unpopular decisions or
unpopular among this band of conservative.
Yes.
But how big are they? How big is that conservative band? I mean, I know
they're
in
not
a primary.
Very big. They're not very big, and they're also comically incompetent as well. Mm. So,
But I guess what I'm saying is, I know in a primary they could hurt you because you could have a much more conservative. But in a general
You could
election,
end up with a Republican in a primary, and it's the last thing
he doesn't want a primary.
In this political climate to have a Republican. But he may not be able to control that, which is why I think he needs to be thinking a little bit more
long-term. But could you see a Republican in a primary beating
him? No, but that doesn't matter. It still costs money.
Oh,
it's still
I see what you're saying. Okay.
You know, it also could help him because it could also give him the symbol he needs to say, look, I'm not worried about labels or partisanship, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, what about the millionaire's tax? I mean, the governor has said he's not in favor of putting taxes on hardworking families. So I guess that includes, or I don't know, does that include hardworking families that are breaking in like, you know, $5 million a year? I don't know. But in any case, you know, Jim has pointed this out a million times, so why not one more? That Governor Baker could really benefit from this. He could seem to be neutral on the millionaire's tax. The millionaire's tax passes, and then he gets the revenue from the millionaire's tax to do things like education.
Absolutely. And this Jim should know, because I always say this is like, you know,
1990.
Jim, you know, failed horrifically to get that question through in 1990, and that's what ended up saving Bill Weld, you know, because they didn't have
Jim
that
didn't
tax.
Fail.
No, he won.
Oh, Jim won.
He won.
Yes, right. I got it backwards.
Yeah.
I got it backwards.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Question
Sorry,
three.
Jim.
It goes too far.
Sorry, Jim.
Jim was fabulous on that issue in 1990.
He's in a different disguise now. He's got a beard.
Yeah. I'm so used to him losing these ballot
You know, Charlie Chipio, may I ask you one more thing? Because I'm going to ask Shannon O'Brien. Actually, I'll ask Shannon O'Brien first because she's a Democrat. You and I are obsessed with pensions, Charlie Chipio.
Yes.
We don't have a pension that's going to get us anywhere. So the T pension has been in trouble for quite some time. We know it's in very serious trouble.
I was at a Carmen's Union briefing about it last week. It was quite amazing.
And? You were?
Yes.
Give us a synopsis.
Yes. There's not a problem in the world.
Oh, there's not a problem in the
world.
It's
all going to be great.
Okay. Here's the thing, Shannon O'Brien, a lot of people get to retire in their 50s in the state of Massachusetts, and you're pretty agile these days, as we all know. 50 is the new 30 or whatever it is. Why
I
not?
I jogged here from Whitman.
Exactly. Exactly. And you look terrific.
Oh, yeah.
Why not? You can retire whenever you want to, but you can't collect till you're 65. Because the T has pointed out they've got more people in retirement with a T. Now, the T is an outlier, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
The rest of the state has run much better than this. But still, people are retiring in their 50s and collecting full pensions in their 50s, while the private citizens, and it's more and more of us, are, you know, working until 65 or 70. Why should anybody collect when they're 50?
Well, I mean, you know, you don't get the full benefit if you take it at that point in time. I mean, just like with Social Security, the longer But I mean, and frankly, they need to change that. I mean, I think that it's unfair.
But you get close to the full benefit. Yeah. You retire as a teacher after 30. Or I shouldn't.
Yeah, but it's,
I'm always picking on teachers. People say I won't say teachers.
Yeah.
Somebody else who retires
but
after 30
saying,
years.
The pensions that most of these people are seeing, you know, when they take it in their 50s is, you know, they're not going to retire on that. No, I'm just kidding. But it's not a lot of money. But I hear you. I mean, people are living longer and they're healthier, but not everybody is. And that's the problem, is that, you know, I know people who, you know, who are in their 60s, late 50s, you know, who have health issues that make it difficult for them to work. That being said, you know, I think that what you have now with the state employees in terms of the cost, okay, those people are pretty much paying for the cost of their own retirement. They
but
take out 11%.
I don't know how that can be true, though. If you work for 30 years and you retire in your 50s and you live to your 90s, how could you?
30 years and you're paying something like 11%
right, but
of 40, your salary.
40 years you're paying nothing.
Well, but
that's what I'm saying. People are living longer than they're working.
But the point is you have put in this much money
that
actuarially, you know, seeds the investment that goes into the pension fund, that then what my job as treasurer and the people in the pension fund to do was to make enough money so that returns would help fund those benefits, you know, for time immemorial. The fact is, when I was treasurer, they were not telling the truth about what the unfunded liability is. So all of this should mathematically work. The problem is that the T, it doesn't work no way, no how. One, you have very early retirements. Two, you have poor investment. I mean, right now, I think they have as many people managing the T retirement fund as they do at PRIM, which is about three times the size of it. So they need to be making sure that they're managing it right, but also they need to be looking at benefits going forward. But just as an issue for the pension, I don't have as much of a problem because I know that over 25, 30 years, they have done a lot of work towards reducing what those benefits are, but also making sure that people are paying for their own benefits.
But Standard & Poor's did note the pension, the state pension, as one of the reasons for the downgrade last week.
And they may not be doing as good a job. I will tell you, when I was treasurer, I had to threaten the legislature and the administration with potential lawsuit because when times get tough, it's like, oh, I have this credit card bill due. I can either pay it now or push it off to the future. And when I was treasurer, I had to fight with them to say, you have to put that money in. And if you don't, I am going to sue you for not funding the pension as you're supposed to.
End up like Illinois.
She didn't put up with any guff over there on Truth. the treasurer of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Good for you, Shannon O'Brien.
All right, Charlie Chipio is principal of Chipio Strategies and senior fellow at both the Governing and Pioneer Institute. Shannon O'Brien is the crusading former state treasurer. And Democratic nominee.
He does really good Bill Clinton imitations. So I just want to point that out. Right. Jim wasn't here.
Coming up, another catastrophe for London was this morning's car crash, a deliberate attack on a mosque. WGBH news analyst Charlie Sennett joins us to go over the latest international headlines. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is off today. Jared Bowen, WGBH's executive arts editor, is filling in. So this morning, a van plowed into a group of Muslim worshippers leading prayers at a pair of mosques. One person is dead. 10 people have been injured in what the mayor, Sadiq Khan, is calling a terrorist attack. It's the third terrorist attack in London in 3 months. Joining us to go over this and other international headlines is Charlie Sennett. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Charlie Sennett, great to talk to you. So,
thanks, Marjorie. It's good to talk to you.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Charlie.
Hi, Jared.
Great to see you.
So, third time in 3 months, London is reeling. What's the latest? What do we know about this latest attack?
Yeah. I think one thing is the context of what is the Finsbury Park Mosque. Just to remind everyone, this is a part of North London that I know well because when I was based there for the Boston Globe, I spent a lot of years out in front of that mosque because that was a place where, remember Richard Reed, the shoe bomber?
Yes.
Comes out of the Finsbury Park Mosque. Massawi, one of the hijackers in 9/11, one of the people involved in the conspiracy that led to the attacks of 9/11. We've had several different imams from the Finsbury Park Mosque who have been convicted on terrorism charges. So it's a setting that has always had a militancy running through it. And the neighborhood there in North London is one of the great melting pots. But that place sort of burns bright red as a symbol of terrorism and of Islamic militancy. And for anyone who would feel like immigration is so out of control in London that we're letting these people in, that would be a very obvious target. So the obvious theory here is someone who I only know as this burly man who was wrestled to the ground and was saying, you know, he wanted to kill Muslims, drove his vehicle into a crowded side street right after the call to prayer. It's Ramadan. That's a very heavy day on the religious calendar for Muslims. So this is a real terrible event at a part of the city well known to tension and well known to militancy. And, you know, I do fear this is retaliation. This is someone who went and said, hey, you're attacking us. We're going to attack you. And that is like, you know, that's where things start to really unravel. It's a really upsetting act of terrorism, as the British authorities are calling it.
What does this mean for Theresa May, who already is countering so much, and these attacks continue to happen and weaken her when she already misstepped in calling this election and has reduced her power?
That's a good question. I don't know how to read the political tea leaves on this. Things are so uncertain right now in European politics. I mean, we, you know, from Macron to May, what's happening and the uncertainty and the way things are just sort of swirling around. I hate to make any predictions. I do think it's interesting that May and others are saying this is an act of terrorism. That's really important because what they're saying is if you attack Muslims, even if this is driven by Islamophobia, we have to recognize that as a form of terror as well. So I think interesting politics at play, interesting dynamic at play. London is one of the great global cities on this earth. It's an amazing place where a lot of immigrants come together. But I still would argue there's something missing in the DNA linkages of a city that thinks of itself as global, but I don't think immigrants feel extremely welcome. We've talked about this a lot. And I also think there's a real streak, a far-right streak, that is more, even more sort of profoundly willing to take action in its own, into its own hands to retaliate against an attack. Look, it's too dangerous to say there are strong trends here, but there's worrisome combustible energy going on in London right now with a series of attacks and now a revenge. I just really hope it isn't a cycle because it's too great a city to have that happen.
But, you know, at the same time, we read about how Macron in France has kind of consolidated his power. I guess not that many people turned out to vote, but nonetheless, the people that turned out to vote gave him a strong show of support. And he's more of a centrist, correct me if I'm wrong. And in Britain, you had a lot of young people coming out to support the Labour Party as opposed, against Theresa May. So certainly, I mean, we talked about this before, but the idea that we were having this right-wing sweep all across Europe and America seems to be certainly in flux.
The tide's shifting back, right?
Yeah.
So, you had the Brexit vote, which was such a dramatic, stunning upset. You know, the idea is that conservative elements within the UK really, really got behind this idea that we should pull out of the EU. It ended up with a stunning upset victory for Brexit. But then what I would call the braking mechanism, a lot of young voters turned out and told Theresa May, like, we're not that into it. Don't do the quick exit on Brexit and actually slow this thing down. Because, of course, young people want to see their own economic future. They want a future that is European. And they are in a preponderance in support of staying in the EU and staying in. That's not going to happen. Brexit's going to go forward. But I do think the vote last time that really hurt Theresa May is this braking mechanism with Macron. This is more than just a stronger showing. This is like a revolution in French politics. I mean, he won 350 of 577 seats in the National Assembly, which is the lower house and really the more powerful house of the among the two houses of parliament in France. You had the sort of center-right Republicans winning 135 seats and socialists on the left winning 45 seats. He crushed both established parties, left and right, created a whole new movement in the middle. It's really exciting. It's going to be pretty interesting to watch what happens to French politics and where Macron will take this as a centrist, 39 years old, super smart, economist by training, a lot to look at there.
Moving on to Cuba, the president, I think, surprised a number of people last week when he decided that he would roll back again another Obama policy, which was, of course, to open up travel to Cuba. And so the restrictions that were in place will likely go back in place. So you just can't go unencumbered without a tour or whatnot. You'll have to be – there will be very specific travel designations to Cuba. What's behind all of this?
I just can't help but think this is just Trump not wanting to be Obama. You know, like anything that that he can do to sort of dismantle what Obama did seems to be the spirit of this, because it's really superficial. It's really very little change in policy. It's not unlike what he's done with the climate agreement, that this is, you know, a theatrical statement of opposition to what President Obama has done. But where does it really take him? Where does he really want to go with this thing? And let's look at this. So you have flights now that you can get on to go to Cuba. It's amazing. I was there 2 months ago or 3 months ago.
Oh, is it great?
It's amazing. Remember, we did the live call from the streets of Havana.
Oh, that's right.
Talking about how exciting it is. Yeah. And restaurants are open. So, of course, we were waiting for something like this to happen. Now it's happened. But apparently it won't cancel flights. It won't mean you can't travel there. It will mean you can't do business there. if you're working with anyone connected to the military, and every business in Cuba is connected to the military. So it's really going to put a damper on business activity there. But I don't think it's going to overwhelmingly transform the idea that Americans can now go to Cuba. I think it was like 600,000 tourists went last year. It was their greatest tour from America, a total of like 5 or 6 million tourists from around the world. The whole world's traveling to Cuba. It's a beautiful place. It's got a sort of faded elegance. It's got those old cars.
I want to see those old cars up close and personal.
And I highly recommend people going there and traveling there. I don't think you can stop the momentum of change that's coming with Cuba, just like you can't stop the momentum of change that's coming with the world coming together to address climate change. So it'll be interesting to see sort of where this all goes. One thing to really watch with Cuba right here in Boston, we can watch this, is Cardinal O'Malley played a critical role in brokering the deal with the Obama administration, breaking this new ground, 50 years of isolation and just shutting Cuba out. The Catholic Church played a very big role in healing that divide, pulling it together. Huge question on the table is, what role will the church play now? And can they be instructive in keeping cultural ties, keeping things moving forward? Again, I don't think you can turn back the clock. I think once there's momentum toward diplomacy, momentum toward opening up, I think it'll go that way. I hope it does.
We're talking with Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth Project. So we heard it was going to be as many as 5,000 troops. Now apparently it's down to 4,000, but that's still an awful lot of troops that we are sending to Afghanistan, the Trump administration is saying. You know, you talked about this a long time ago, this forever stand idea, mm-hmm. and obviously it is forever stand. Three presidents have been dealing with this Afghanistan war, and I'm driven a little crazy by this term that we're going over there to train and advise all these Afghan troops. First of all, because the people that are doing the dastardly things don't seem to need very much training and advising, and they're killing with quite alacrity. I mean, ISIS, Taliban, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And second of all, I don't believe we're training and advising at all. I think that we're right in the thick of things. At least that's what Seth Moulton, the congressman, said that was in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Training and advising is just kind of a cover word. But again, It's just we have just the defense secretary Jim Mattis, the military guy, seeming to just be running the show without going through Congress, and the president not really getting that involved.
I think you put your finger right on it, Marjorie. This is what really interests me about this shift in policy. Going, you know, I think we have 8,800 troops in there now, and 6,000 are troops, and 2,000 are these quote advisors and counterterrorism officials. And that number, 8,800, will now climb up another between 3 and 5. Let's say it's 4. So you'd be up over 12,000. And it's really clear that President Trump has just outsourced this to the generals. So what's worrisome about that? On the one hand, look, Jim Mattis is really smart. He's a great general. He's a great leader. I trust him. I feel like there's an adult in the room whenever I hear Mattis's name mentioned in this crazy political environment of Trump tweeting policies and acting out. Here's a guy who brings stability, right? So that's a good thing on the one hand. On the other hand, it's really worrisome when the president of the United States starts to turn over control of military philosophy, our goals, our ambitions, our strategy to the generals. That diminishes the civilian control over the military. I worry about that. I worry about a cabinet that has a lot of generals in it. I admire them all. I still worry about the erosion of civilian control.
Well, not to mention a lack of employees in the Defense Department, like every other agency. I mean, how can this even be managed?
You know, it's a great question, and I think the question is like, what are we managing? What's the strategy?
This is like
a tactic in search of a strategy. We still haven't heard what's the overall goal. What does this mean? If the broad goal, really broadly determined, is we need to be in there because we have to have the ability to sustain some semblance of institutional democracy within Afghanistan. Girls need to go to school. There needs to be a parliament. We have to have some institutions that can uphold something like a society that has some participatory politics, if not democracy. We can't let the Taliban march right in again and reestablish its control over the country. I don't think that would be good for the Afghan people. It definitely wouldn't be good for U.S. foreign policy and our geopolitical interests in the region. It's how we ended up with 9/11. The Taliban walked in. Al-Qaeda took root. Taliban gave them cover. And we ended up with the greatest attack on our country since Pearl Harbor. So I think there's a lot at stake. I tend to be more hawkish on this one than other policies. We disagree on this, Marjorie. I actually think just pulling out jeopardizes some things that we have done that are successful there, including the education of girls in schools. Mm-hmm. It is transforming a generation. At Forever Stan, our series, this is what we looked at, right? Beth Murphy, our great head of Ground Truth Film, spent 3 years in a girls' school in Afghanistan.
Great.
And watched really up close and personal how that changes a whole village, a whole region. So I think there have been gains there that have been hard fought. American lives were lost for those gains. Many Afghans' lives were lost. Trillions of dollars have been spent. Look, we have long-lasting military presence in places where we've fought all over the world, whether that's in Japan or Germany or Korea or even in the Baltic, in the Balkans. Because if you think about our military successes over time, they often take a sustained troop presence to hold on to those victories. And those are long-fought victories, and they require a sustenance of troops to keep it going. So I get your impatience with, like, let's get out of there, and Seth Moulton is so smart, but I don't think even Seth is saying let's just cut and run. He might not like this troop increase,
yeah,
or he might want to hear a better strategy, but I think we need to really think strategically, and that's what we're not seeing from the White House. Where's the strategy? Here's a troop increase, but where are you going to go with this? Hopefully we'll hear from Mattis what that strategy is, because he's going to have to go and ask for those troops, and we're going to have some debate about it. I hope so. I really hope so.
We haven't had one yet, have we?
No.
But in the meantime, we have the ambassador, Dennis Rodman, running over to North Korea, handing over Donald Trump's Art of the Deal to the North Koreans. What?
I know.
First of all, I don't even understand how Dennis Rodman gets to go to North Korea.
Well, that weirdness has been going on. It's bipartisan, right? Because it was happening also
with President
Obama. Look, Dennis Rodman's a freak, and watching him hand Kim Jong-un Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, is to me the quintessential American moment for the times we live in. We have Ambassador Dennis Rodman in the era of a Trump presidency, like the head of The Apprentice meets this NBA freak. It's all about marketing. It's all about branding. And I'm starting to grow despondent about, like, how are we expressing ourselves in the world? And I'm not alone in that. A lot of our allies are worried. What's happening here in America? Like, where are we on really strategic thinking, our foreign policy, the way we carry ourselves in the world? I think we all feel like we live in this cartoon-like moment where you have these things going on. But actually, it really matters how we carry ourselves in the world. And our allies are kind of looking at each other with a side glance, like, what is happening over here? So we should be concerned.
One last thing, Charlie Sennett.
Sure.
Vladimir Putin, of course, is the Russian president, says that that if we have any more sanctions on them, that that's going to hurt the country. And despite all these other things going on, the Senate, with Russia, that is, the Senate, 98-2, actually, approved sanctions against Russia to approve them for the election interference. So I guess this is the expected response we would get.
Yeah, I don't see much. So, I mean, yeah, he doesn't want sanctions. Okay, well,
yeah.
The question is this: what really is interesting about this is this puts President Trump in a bind, because he has said he didn't want those sanctions. Now it will look really terrible after he fires Comey, after he admits now that he is being investigated for obstruction of justice, and we have all of this smoke just swirling around the issue of this administration's relationship to Russia. To think that Trump would come out in front of this thing and say, no, we're going to back off on the sanctions when the Senate votes, 98-2 in favor?
98-2.
It would just be too weird. Even Trump isn't going to go there. And there is no one, not even Dennis Rodman, who can change this thing.
But, you know, I do wonder, because a lot of Republicans have supported Donald Trump in other areas. So why this almost unanimity about sanctions against Russia? We're soft on commies. Is that the idea?
No, I think it's to say, hey, you tampered with our election. You're trying to undercut our democracy. Here's where we unite. This was, I thought, the most powerful statement Comey made in his
testimony. Oh, my God. It was great. They're coming for us.
Yeah, he said, we're losing this. As we get more and more partisan in our debate on this issue, we're losing the fact that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that Russia right now is in a concerted effort to undermine Western democracies. The United States, France, Germany in its upcoming elections, they're going to all be seeing this. And we need to care about that. And I think this is the Senate sort of manning up on that thing or womaning up and manning up and saying, we are not going to accept this. And we are going to, we're actually going to impose these sanctions. It's not a game changer. The sanctions aren't tough enough, but it's an important message to send at an important time.
Yeah, I'm always wondering, is somebody actually doing anything about our future elections to make sure that we're more secure? I mean, I don't hear much about that. Do you?
I'm worried. I think we do need to really get ready because the last thing we need is a real upset in the midterm elections.
Exactly,
that
and you don't
undercuts
get
a dramatic transformation of our
exactly,
political landscape.
Exactly, that our focus is on preventing this happening again. But anyway,
we better stay focused on. Let's keep them on it.
Thank you.
Okay.
We're all over it.
I don't want to be the cynical one here, but I think a lot of people were trying to be on it the first time around.
I know. Right. We got a lot of work to do.
Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at GBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Always great to talk to you, Charlie.
Thanks, you guys.
Up next, we're opening up the lines and asking you, should we be keeping up with the Alex Joneses? Did Megyn Kelly's interview with him expose him or promote him? Should the media be giving men like Alex Jones and Vladimir Putin airtime or not? We're asking you next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio, we kick things off in hour number two, opening the lines, asking you about Megyn Kelly's interview with Alex Jones. Is it a service to the public to expose him for who he is, or is it a platform for him to further his agenda and propaganda? From there, we'll get TV expert Bob Thompson's take on how the media are handling power players like Vladimir Putin and Jones, plus his best and worst TV moments of the week.
I'm Jared Bowen, in for Jim Browdy. Before he came to Boston to run the Museum of Fine Arts, Matthew Teitelbaum had a reputation for reviving Toronto's arts and culture scene. Now he's aiming to do the same thing here by the way of a new plan for the MFA. He joins us to lay out his vision for the museum and the community. From there, we'll look at what Bill Cosby has and hasn't meant for the black community. Did he abandon them long before he became TV's favorite dad? Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price weigh in on that, plus their weekly Pope Watch. That is all next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
I am Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio. WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen is in for Jim Browdy, who has the day off. So last night, NBC ran Megyn Kelly's interview with conspiracy theorist, right-wing personality, and founder of InfoWars, Alex Jones. In this exchange, Megyn Kelly confronts Alex Jones about his claim that the Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown was a hoax.
All of the parents decided to come out and lie about their dead children.
I didn't say that.
What happened to the children?
I will sit there on the air and look at every position and play devil's advocate.
Was that devil's advocate? The whole thing is a giant hoax. The whole thing was fake.
Yes, because I remember then saying, but then some of it looks like it's real. But then what do you do when they've got the kids going in circles in and out of the building with their hands up? I've watched the footage, and it looks like a drill.
So Media Matters, a liberal advocacy site that had originally sounded the alarms in this interview, said it was, quote, a well-edited investigation of the dangers posed by an unstable megalomaniac with millions of loyal fans, unquote. But Margaret Sullivan argued that it only helped Alex Jones, tweeting, still a win for him, boosts his profile. This is, has become a big controversy in the journalism world, whether the Margaret Sullivan, who's longtime been an ombudsperson, was right, that this just brought somebody onto NBC News where millions of people could see him that maybe didn't know about him and gave him more publicity, or was the Media Matters, as I just said, they're the liberal group that had criticized the appearance, were they right that she really did, as a Politico headline says, Megyn Kelly pantses Alex Jones, that short of waterboarding him, there was little more she could have done to expose his dark methods. Should this have been on television, or should it not have been on television? The Sandy Hook parents, needless to say, were extremely upset that Alex Jones was given this kind of publicity. And they talked about a campaign of harassment against them, with people coming up to them. And these are parents that have lost, you know, first graders, and harass them and say they made up this story. This is terrible. They were obviously upset. So what do you think about this? I have to say, on this one, I could come down on either side of this. I could get the point that this guy is a real sleazy guy. On the other hand, he has the ear of the President of the United States.
Well, and that's exactly why I think that there is value in this. As reprehensible as what he has to say is, and of course he has done so much damage to these families and what he's put out there. And we should also mention that the Hartford station made the decision not to air this interview last night. But at the same time, as you just mentioned, he does have the ear of the president. He does have 2 million subscribers to InfoWars. So like it or not, this is a man who has a presence. And I think that there's value in hearing from people like that so that we can understand these types of personalities. And I have to, full disclosure, I have the opportunity to see the interview last night, but from everything I'm reading, as you just said from the Politico headline, she pantsed him, she eviscerated him, that it was a very intense interview. And in terms of how she interrogated him about all of these various beliefs that he has, but that also calls into question, which we can talk about too, whether or not this interview was re-edited after this furor sprang up last week, which people are saying that there was one interview that was supposed to take place and it was re-edited to make it look much more journalistically sound.
Yes. Our number is 877-301-8970. The email address is bpr@wgbh.org. I always forget that. bpr@wgbh.org. Yeah, I got it right. So what do you think about this? That's a great point, Jared, that the you know what hit the fan, and when it did, NBC said, well, hold on, we're gonna edit this to make it look tougher. There was also this tactic by Jones where he tape recorded all their conversations, including the conversations they had setting up the interview, where she says, oh, I'm going to be fair and balanced. It's not going to be a hit job. He taped all those conversations, and apparently he's showing he's airing all those conversations on his website, as well as the unedited interview. I'm not clear about how he would have the unedited interview, but there's talk about his doing that as well. But the thing is, as I just said, Donald Trump, the president, has seen things on Alex Jones' radio show and mentioned them. One of the things they mentioned in the interview last night was that there was Alex Jones was saying that there were some Mexicans that were carrying drugs across, they were swimming across the water with drugs. And then Donald Trump mentions, and this is an unverified story, the same thing at a rally, the Pizzagate thing that we mentioned. These stories just don't stay on InfoWars. They go from InfoWars to Breitbart to Drudge. And the Drudge Report is a huge driver of radio and television coverage all around the country. It's probably one of the most clicked on websites in the whole United States of America. And a lot of Alex Jones stuff gets on there. So Kelly asks Jones about his relationship with President Donald Trump. Here's what Jones and Kelly had to say about that friendship.
Jones's influence hit new heights when he attracted a very famous fan, then presidential candidate Donald Trump.
I just want to finish by saying your reputation's amazing.
In December 2015, Mr. Trump appeared on Jones's radio program, offering praise and promises.
I will not let you down. You will be very, very impressed, I hope.
And when Mr. Trump won, Alex Jones found himself with access to the seat of power. InfoWars got a temporary White House press pass for the first time, and Jones says Mr. Trump called him after the election to thank him for his help.
So there you go. I mean, White House press pass. Alex Jones said that it was not a friendship with the president, but he talked about how the president has called him. They've had conversations, and the president obviously either sees his site or sees his site via these other news sites like InfoWars and Breitbart. And you know something? I think a lot of people may not have known about InfoWars before because they're not spending their time on fringe websites. They're just not.
Well, and I think that goes both ways because people are, and again, I think this is the value in an interview like this or a piece like this because you are exposed. So it helps you lock things into place here as you understand more about how some of this media is working and who the major personalities are that are driving this, especially, again, as we've mentioned, they have the president's ear. But at the same time, the critics say that she has just elevated his profile. So where he had 2 million already, who knows how many people gravitate toward him last night. But I'm not sure. I think that's a fairly specious argument, because that's going to happen no matter who you put on television.
And one last thing before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970. Charles Sykes, who was a talk show host for many years in Iowa, he's a conservative. He now is written a lot of pieces about the conservative movement today. And he points out that back when William F. Buckley, yeah, the darling of the conservatives, a brilliant guy. He used to be on TV debating with Gore Vidal. They go back and forth. Sykes pointed out in a great piece in the New York Times yesterday that William F. Buckley denounced the John Birch Society at the time for their horrible tactics and their racism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Sykes is making the point that you do not see a lot of mainstream conservatives trashing these nutty outliers that think that 9/11 was an inside job and children weren't killed at Sandy Hook. They're not trashing them because I think it's become almost a piece because some of this stuff winds up as well on Fox News. So anyway, that is the question. Should we have publicized, not should we, I wasn't there, should Megyn Kelly and NBC have publicized Alex Jones, or should they have allowed him to remain underneath his rock? But it is a rock where at least 2 million people, if not many more people, have access to what he has to say. So let's go to Tori in Worcester. Hi, Tori.
Hi, first-time caller. Happy to be on the show.
Oh, thank you for calling.
And I just want to say I agree with all of the opinions you have, but I strongly feel, especially with Donald Trump being our president, we are giving more and more people who, you know, 10 years ago were Reagan Republicans, of which I feel I am one, would have never allowed this interview to continue. And I would like to even pose the fact that, you know, I bet the leader of the KKK, you know, which I've been to towns where it's still active in the South. I went to school in the South, so I literally met members of the KKK. But, you know, he's not getting an NBC interview. You know, she's not going around interviewing other very, you know, I would say, questionable figures around the world. And for Megyn Kelly to give Alex Jones that platform, I think literally shames the name of all of the people who died in 9/11. And then on top of Sandy Hook, I mean, it's disgusting that she literally gave him the platform. And I am very concerned that people watched that interview and thought, maybe he's right, and now they are going to InfoWars, you know, every day.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, Pizzagate. It was nothing, and it was on the Drudge Report or on, you know, those conservative websites of which, you know, Marjorie checked, I checked. But now more and more people are thinking, oh, maybe he was right, and maybe, you know, he's got that view. And that's what I think in Donald Trump's presidency, that's what's wrong. That's mainly what's wrong, is nobody is, especially the media, I would say, you know, needs to be diligent in saying, this is false. This is a lie. This is not true. We will not promote these things, but even on the campaign trail, he was spewing lies, and it was being aired live.
Now, Tori, we got it. Thank you. I mean, that's what a lot of people are saying about this, that we have given this guy coverage that he didn't deserve. But then you have someone like Roger Stone. Roger Stone, we should point out, is under investigation. Well, we think he's under investigation anyway for ties with Russia. He's one of Trump's major advisors. He talks about that Jones, as I said before, promoted by the Drudge Report, as Tori just said, which is one of the most heavily trafficked websites in the country. And this is a piece from the Charles Sykes story in the New York Times. This is Roger Stone's quote about Alex Jones. Alex Jones may be the single most important voice in the alternative conservative media. Alex Jones. Now, you have two people that are very close to the president, Steve Bannon and that Gorka guy, Sebastian Gorka, who strikes me as a little odd when I see him on television. But they traffic in the same sort of thing. It's a war of civilizations between Islam and Christianity, and between black and white and life and death. And this is the same kind of things Alex Jones traffics in. So you've got Alex Jones, Breitbart, Drudge, sometimes Fox News, and two men that are very close to the president.
And I think a lot more people after, as we discussed, there's the risk that, and as Tori mentioned too, that a lot of people will be attracted to this and what he has to say and support him. But I think after last night, there are also a lot more people who are aware of what's happening, don't you think? And it can put some of those systems, connect those dots.
Well, I hope so, because I think, like I said, now I'm arguing the other side, saying I think it is good that we know about these people, because then we've talked a million times about Hillary Clinton with her thousands of guillotines that she purchased. I'm not saying that came from Alex Jones, but it came from someplace and wound up on people's Facebook pages. I think that was part of the Russian influence, all these crazy stories. So you might know that maybe when you see something that seems a little odd, like Sandy Hook was a hoax, which is horrific, or that Hillary Clinton is loading up on guillotines, you might think, really?
Hopefully. Anyway, let's go to Alexa in Ashland. Hi there.
Hi. So while we're talking about Alex Jones and Megyn Kelly, I think the most important thing is we have to look at the history of Alex Jones and who he is. And, he is the man who has claimed that there's a chemical in juice boxes that turns our children into homosexuals, apart from the other conspiracy theories.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Here's the figure who's been doing this for a long time, and you have the followers. So he doesn't need a bigger platform by Megyn Kelly. I think that was ridiculous, because I can guarantee you, if anything, waking up today, he probably has more followers than less.
Yeah, well, that is the risk that people that had never heard of him would now start looking at his stuff. Did you see the picture? Did you see the interview by any chance last night, Alexa?
Well, I didn't. Well, because I was not going to give it a rating.
Well, one of my favorite parts was when he talked about how much money he makes selling. I always tease Jim about this, these male virility pills. And then you see Alex Jones with no shirt on, posing like in a muscle pose, showing off his biceps. And the whole thing was just horrible. But he really sweated a lot in the interview. He was perspiring all over the place. He looked like he was lying. She nailed him on when he refused to apologize for these things. So if you did see it, I think you would think this guy is a real jerk. I think you would think he's a nut and a jerk. And what she should have said is that in his custody battle with his ex-wife, his lawyer is claiming that he's just a performance artist. He just makes all this stuff up. This isn't what he really believes. This isn't who he is. He doesn't have anger management issues. He doesn't have this, he's not a raging guy when he's home with his children. So there you go. He wants to get the kids in a custody fight, and suddenly he says he's making all this stuff up.
Right. Well, I think we've heard that about other radio personalities, too, over the years. It doesn't go as deep as you think. But I think I'm also curious as to why Megyn Kelly even did this. I mean, here she's just launching her show, and is this supposed to be the interview that gets massive ratings to get Alex Jones?
Well, you know something? Our colleague, Emily Rooney, had a brilliant observation about Megyn Kelly. You know, Megyn Kelly has done a lot of dastardly things. For example, she says Santa Claus was white. That caused a lot of uproar on Fox News. And other people have said she carried too much water for Fox News when she was at Fox News. But the thing she's really good at is live interviewing. She's very quick, you know, the one-on-one back and forth. And Emily said what the show should be, instead of trying to turn this into sort of 60 Minutes Light or NBC Dateline or something, they should just focus on her doing live interviews. If she had done a live interview, even with Alex Jones, that wasn't all edited, you could put the context at the beginning or the end or something like that. It would have been just having her do what she excelled at instead of turning into something that she's not.
And then how much sweat would there have been if it was live? Then he really would have been in trouble.
I know.
All right, let's go to Michael in Watertown. Hi, Michael.
Hi. About 30 years ago, I put out an early draft of a physics paper using a laser printer, and I took one look at it, and I thought, I better look at this really, really carefully because this looks like it's already typeset. And it looks authoritative, and there might easily be mistakes in it that I would miss. And I think that's a big part of the problem. It used to be that in order to get something published, you had to be credible enough to enough people with money that you could get something well typeset, or no good graphics. And this acted as a kind of filter, and it acted in the interest of people who had money, but it also helped to eliminate a lot of the fringe. You knew that when something was crudely mimeographed, that it wasn't from someone who had attracted a lot of attention. I think it's a basic crisis in authentication. I'd been hoping that maybe children who had been raised with the internet would be better at finding some other ways of filtering out crazies from non-crazies. I still think that good grammar is maybe one way, but if you look at a Trump speech, I don't think that really holds.
Well, Michael, that's a great point, Michael. Thank you for the call. I mean, the idea that anybody can get on the internet and kind of spout whatever they want to spout, and he's been at it for quite some time. I think he started a little tiny local television station, and he's just gotten more and more popular. And, after the election, where I was sort of surprised that President Trump won, I started spending more time looking at InfoWars and looking at Breitbart and looking at Drudge, which the stories on Drudge are true, but the headlines are misleading often, and they're placed in a way that you wouldn't really know the main story of the day was the main story of the day, because they bury it often if it's not aligned with their thinking. But in any case, it's unbelievable. You look at this guy screaming and yelling and carrying on with these crazy guests, and it's kind of like watching, a boxing match or something. And I think there's a certain part of the country that just loves that kind of thing.
Well, and that's my point. And I think that's why, and again, it's not easy to look at. And there is risk, which all of our callers have talked about. But at the same time, I think it's important to understand that. Because I think it also helps you understand how a lot of what's happening in the country now is happening. When you see these figures and you're allowed to kind of dismantle them when Megyn Kelly isn't dismantling them.
Yeah.
So you can take a look and see who these figures are and how they're operating and why they're operating, and and if there is, try to apply their own logic to these situations.
And you don't know whether he's doing this because he is just sees that this is how he can make a lot of money, become a multimillionaire. Because how can you really believe? How can anybody believe that Sandy Hook was unreal? It's just crazy. But he still wouldn't apologize for it last night, even when she had him right there hanging by a thread like a little spider. Curtis in Westboro, what do you think, Curtis?
Hello. I haven't been listening to this whole conversation, but just part of it, and I didn't hear the Alex Jones interview. However, it seems that the question of Alex Jones is not really the question. It's more kind of an ad hominem attack, and it's kind of this cult of personality we have in this country as opposed to ideas. Who cares what the individual personality of Alex Jones thinks or says? He's bringing up ideas that are not necessarily part of the mainstream media. And the mainstream media historically hasn't done its job in questioning government, such as the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So I think bringing up any kind of ideas that are out of the mainstream is good. And then on the other side, you have someone like...
Hold on. Hold on for a second, Curtis. You can't slide by that one so quickly. What exactly has the has people like Alex Jones done that's legitimate about questioning government? I mean, I would remind you that we kind of the mainstream media did goof a lot in Vietnam, different time where we're a lot more trusting of our government. But I think the mainstream media has certainly learned, and there is nonstop questioning of the government now. Look at the Boston Globe. Look at the Washington Post, the New York Times. I mean, my goodness, they're questioning the government and the Trump administration at every turn. What has the other side done?
What I would say is the questioning of the government is still more kind of ad hominem attacks against Donald Trump as opposed to actual policy. And the breadth of debate is very narrow in this country. And someone like Noam Chomsky, who's very respected as a scholar, gets no airtime whatsoever because his views are not part of that very narrow mainstream corporate discussion, really.
Yeah.
And so whether it's the right or left side, ideas are only good. Bringing ideas to light is good. People can look into them and make a decision for themselves. But to squelch ideas with this kind of paternalistic view of, oh, we're only going to tell you what we think you should know, I don't think is right.
Yeah. Curtis, I just don't buy that for one second. A lot of the so-called mainstream media problems with Donald Trump have been his policies. And it's certainly not just Donald Trump's policies. It's the healthcare thing is not about Donald Trump's personality. It's about what could happen to healthcare. So, and the same thing with taxes and the same thing with a lot of his initiatives. They are his ideas, or at least the Republican government's ideas. But I am biased because I've been part of the mainstream media my whole life, and I think these ideas, these notions are just, I think people don't see enough of what the mainstream media has done, especially newspapers. They're keeping the government honest, if you ask me. But Matthew from Somerville, what do you think, Matthew?
So I used to work on Wall Street. I helped create some of the systems that made high-speed trading possible, and every time there's a high-speed trade on Wall Street and somebody makes $20 or $100 million, that's in effect a way of taxing the rest of us, but we don't agree on it, not in policy, and the government has made sure that that's not even on the table. What we're seeing is, in effect, regulatory capture, that a third of our economy has been sucked into this financial world, and whether it's Trump or
Matthew, what are we talking about? Megyn Kelly, whether Megyn Kelly should have been on television last night interviewing Alex Jones?
Popular is because the mainstream media has failed to do the giant headline, which is we're all getting screwed and we have a right to be angry about it. And the mainstream media is missing the forest for the trees and creating
Matthew, can we get back to can we get back to Megyn Kelly and Alex Jones?
Yeah, that's why they have a platform, is because the mainstream media is failing to scream from the rooftops every day that our government and system has been taken over by the financial industry, you know, in a way political scientists call regulatory capture.
Okay, Matthew, I think we know that. That was what the recession of 2007-2008 was all about. Everybody was talking about Wall Street owning America. So I think we did cover that. But thank you for the call nonetheless. Let's get back to what we were talking about here. Let's hope to get back to what we were talking about here. Was the case of the Alex Jones interview last night on the NBC show, which Megyn Kelly now hosts. She, of course, was a longtime host on Fox News, left Fox News, and is now starting this new show. Alex Jones is a very controversial person. Many people have never heard of him. Now many more people have heard of him. But he does have a very loyal following, at least 2 million people, and I would argue it's many more than that, because what he says on InfoWars is picked up by, as I said before, Breitbart, Drudge, which is probably one of the biggest websites, news websites in the country, and also by Fox News, and also by the President of the United States. Should he have been on television last night, or was it important to get his perspective, odd though it is? Ada in Sudbury, what do you think, Ada?
Hi, Marjorie. So I'll admit that I didn't watch the interview last night because I wasn't particularly interested in watching Alex Jones lie and sweat on TV. But I feel like what would be more interesting for Megyn Kelly to explore is not so much hearing his opinions, which are already given a loud platform, but having her explore more, why are so many people susceptible to these types of conspiracy theories? People all the way up to the president. You know, why is that happening? Why is it
That's a great question.
More and more happening? And what do we do to change it?
What do you think? What do you think?
I honestly don't really understand why people are so susceptible to it, because it seems to me more and more we're hearing on the news so many things that disprove a lot of the crazy conspiracy theories, and yet people still hang on to them, even in the face of obvious evidence. They don't want to believe it. They just want to hold on to these kinds of crazy stories. And so I'm kind of at a loss, and I find it a little bit, it's depressing, because if you can't get through to people with clear information, if they just want to hold on to conspiracy theories, then where are we headed?
Ada, thank you very much. I should point out that Alex Jones had really horrible things to say as well about the concert over in London. Is it Ariana Grande? Is that her first name?
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of young teenagers were at that concert. A lot of little kids were there with their parents. Megyn Kelly last night asked Jones about his claim that the victims in this concert bombing, it was in London, it was in Manchester, were quote-unquote liberal trendies.
You said it was a bunch of liberal trendies who were killed. The same people who are promoting open borders, bringing Islamists in.
Yes.
In response to which, many people looked at the victims, many of whom were 15, 14. There was a little...
I'm sorry I didn't blow them up. I know, but I did something bad, though.
No, an eight-year-old, right? There was Safi Rose Rousseau, 8 years old, that she was a liberal trendy.
Yeah, no, that the media misrepresenting and clipping that the way you did.
Okay. So he took a lot of flack for that, and he didn't really go back and apologize for that either. He didn't apologize for Sandy Hook or really for Pizzagate. He did apologize because he had a lawsuit because he said nasty things about a yogurt company that was bringing Mexican rapists in to make the Chobani yogurt, and he was sued. And he's sort of apologized when he's been sued, but that's been about it.
Yeah, I was just looking at the population of Boston, which is 655,000. So if he has 2 million subscribers, that's 3 times the city of Boston. This is why I'm so stuck on this, because there is such a sizable population out there of people who are listening to him. And I know I'm repeating myself, but I think we just need to know where they're coming from or why they're thinking or who their leader is, and to see him act in person.
Yeah.
Also, this is a person who is very much on the defensive, because from his own recordings that he released, he walked into this thinking that Megyn Kelly, in her words, is going to do some sort of piece that wouldn't be gotcha, and they quote unquote would find some level of humanity in the work that he does.
Yeah. Well, we'll wrap this up by saying, too, that the important link here is that he is someone that is read at least sometimes by the President of the United States. And some of the unverified accusations Alex Jones has made on his website wind up being made by the President. And obviously, President's most powerful man on earth, and he's running the country, and that's one of the reasons it was so upsetting. But like I said at the beginning, I could go either way on this, keep him under the rock or bring him out. I don't know. What do you think of leaving this?
Well, Jim always accuses me of flip-flopping, which is what I typically do. I mean, as I said, I thought there was value in all of this, but I do understand the caller's points that, there is the huge liability of more people being attracted to this by having a network primetime interview when, as one caller said, he didn't necessarily need to have that because he already reaches a lot of people. All right, well, coming up, Bob Thompson joins us to talk about the best and worst TV moments of the week. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jared Bowen is in for Jim Browdy. So from Megyn Kelly's interview with Alex Jones to Oliver Stone's serial one-on-ones with Vladimir Putin, are the media doing right by the public in how they handle people in power? Joining us on the line to talk about these and other TV developments is Bob Thompson. He's a professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Bob, great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you guys.
So we just spent 20 minutes or so talking to our listeners about the rights and wrongs of Megyn Kelly having Alex Jones. He has kind of been this very far-right kind of fringe figure, conspiracy theorist, didn't think Sandy Hook happened, et cetera, on her NBC show last night. And before we get to what else we want to talk to you about today, having seen the interview last night, what do you think? Should she have done it? Was she right or was she wrong?
Well, I think all these people that were, and a lot of people were saying that, this interview shouldn't have happened. He shouldn't have been given this forum. And I can understand a lot of those arguments. But one of the things journalists are supposed to do is to expose people who are, and let's face it, Alex Jones has got a lot of followers, the ear of the president. Megyn Kelly was very defensive in pointing that all out to justify why she had done it. And I think it was by no means a PR opportunity for Alex Jones. It was a pretty straightforward expose of how many of the things he has claimed have been wrong. Wasn't very long. Maybe putting it on Father's Day was a little odd, but I think it was an okay interview.
Well, this is obviously your area of expertise, and there's so much conversation here about the business behind this interview and why she did this interview. Obviously, she's launching her show. She's really trying to make a new name for herself or raise up her name at NBC now. And we know that he recorded elements of her conversation and her pitch how she would portray this interview, which sounds like at first it was going to be we're going to find some of the humanity in you. And it, he says, because he's planning on releasing his recordings of this conversation, that that she had a very different agenda about this all along, and it was not what we saw last night, which was much more combative. What do you make of how this all came to be?
Yeah, well, that is an interesting story because, yes, apparently he's got these recordings that she said that, she's not going to rake him over the coals and all of that. And if it was a report in the New York Post that apparently after all the complaints that she was going to do this, they went back and re-edited it to make it harsher, which is an interesting idea that you listen to public response and then re-edit your interview to make it seem different than it may otherwise have been. I don't know what it was like in the first place, so I can't judge. And you also point out, right, that this is a brand new show. Her first episode did okay. Her second episode went down 46% in the ratings.
Wow.
And this thing did get a lot of attention. I haven't seen the ratings for last night yet. We'll have to wait for those for a little bit. So there are a lot of elements that went into doing this and what it actually looked like. And we don't have all the details as to how that actually went down.
So, Bob Thompson, what's your worst of this week?
Well, this was a week where all kinds of terrible things happened, and what I'm about to say is by no means the worst of what happened in the world today, but since we're sticking to television, I'm going to give it to the Oliver Stone epic four-part, four-hour-long Showtime interview, I guess we would call it, with Vladimir Putin. However, I'm putting it a worst in that it was not – was this journalism yet? Was it interesting? Da.
Oh, well, I read this review in The Guardian which talked about how – by the way, we should play – let's play a clip from this first to get an idea of what we're talking about. Oliver Stone sitting down and apparently driving around and apparently getting an awful lot of access to Vladimir Putin. Here's a clip from the trailer.
The Western people don't know much about you. You're credited with doing many things. You reformed the army. The privatization was stopped. 5 assassination attempts. The real son of Russia. In a hot war, is the U.S. dominant?
Я думаю, что никто бы не пережил.
Okay, so no rules. Why did you hack the election? They say you want to be czar. Did you make a mistake in Crimea? You didn't answer my question.
Well, finally, you're admitting it.
You look like a fox who just got out of the hen house.
So on the one hand, it seems fawning. On the other hand, The Guardian said it wasn't a total fawning moment, that he looked bad in some parts and actually displayed a sense of humor during her playing of Dr. Strangelove.
Well, yeah, that was probably the most interesting. I believe that was episode 2, where he makes a reference to Dr. Strangelove, and Putin apparently hasn't seen it. So a little bit later in the episode, Oliver Stone and his people are pleased to get a DVD, and together they sit down and watch it in what was obviously one of the most awkward moments of the whole interview, but funny nevertheless. And then they discuss it a little bit. I think there should be a spinoff series where Oliver Stone goes to all the great leaders of the world and watches Stanley Kubrick films with them. But anyway, they talk about how, you know, nobody would survive a nuclear attack and everything. It was a very different thing than we would have expected from a journalist. And at times, really weird. At one point, Oliver Stone goes, they meet again, and he says, did you miss me? And Putin says, yes, I was crying from time to time, but now we're together again. And then another point where Stone, when they get back together, Oliver Stone says, okay, you walk in here and pretend you haven't seen me for months. And then Stone actually says the word action, which journalists know you're not supposed to do. And that, I think, if anything, demonstrated that not only do we know, but that Stone knows that this is not a piece of traditional journalism. It's something else entirely. And if we look at this as a four-hour film, and the opening credits certainly look like a movie, not a journalistic interview, then I guess we go to it with a different set of expectations.
Well, and I didn't get to see this, but do we know what Oliver Stone's expectations were, especially knowing his body of work?
Yeah.
JFK, he created lots of controversy. He took this look at Nixon in his epic film there. And then this was done over a number of years. So do we know at the outset, or did this get shaped later?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Far be it for me to get into the mind of Oliver Stone, because it's a complicated place. But you did get the sense. I hate using the word bromance, but you did get the sense that Oliver Stone was actually kind of enchanted to be not only in the presence of this world leader, but very much felt himself as an equal. He was very informal. He was not deferential in most cases, and he seemed to be having a good time. And Putin, as far as he can seem to be having a good time, maybe seemed to be having it as well. And it did. If people complain that this humanizes a guy that's done a lot of bad things, it did do that. You got the sense that this wasn't just the distant other. We got to see that he was a human being. And I suppose there is some value to that, although it's fraught with problems.
You know, one of the things that I thought was rather interesting is that we found out that when Putin and United States presidents, at least in the case of Barack Obama, had conversations, they called each other Barack and Vladimir. I kind of liked it. It was very casual, which I thought was sort of neat. What's your best, Bob Thompson?
Oh, I'm giving my best Friday. We got the new season of The Great British Baking Show.
Oh, great.
2 episodes, cakes and biscuits. Biscuits, by the way, are what we Yankees would call cookies. But Marjorie, wasn't it you that turned me on to this a long time ago?
You know, a good friend, one of my kids' friends said, you should watch this show. And I did watch it. And I get it. I've been remiss in following and keeping up with it. But I get the appeal. I mean, they seem to be nicer than our cooking shows, which are kind of cutthroat.
Right. And I'm not a big fan of cooking shows, but I really have come to like this show. And you're right. It is nice. The worst thing said in the biscuits episode was that's more like a scone than a biscuit. That's harsh talk. That's trash talk for the Great British Baking Show.
We have a clip from this, too, that we can play for people who haven't seen it. I know a lot of people that are really into this show. I mean, here's a very dramatic scene. This is from the premiere of the Great British Baking Show.
The bakers now face a crucial decision.
Right, I'm going in.
If their sponges are even slightly underbaked,
no.
They could disintegrate when soaked with drizzle.
Might just give it 5 minutes. That'd give me time to stir my custard.
And I listen to my cakes and they're not ready. They sing. And they say, not ready, not ready.
And this is one of the most popular shows, right, in Great Britain?
It's like an episode of 24. Will that drizzle make the sponge cake disintegrate? You really care as though as though it has some kind of world repercussions. And it plays here in the U.S. now on a Friday, which is just about the time that you would like to think that the worst thing we have to worry about is someone's drizzle cake collapsing. By the way, spoiler alert for episode 2, biscuits fall.
Oh, my God, the biscuits
on the
fall.
Floor.
How can it be?
Now, the other thing about this has been, this is its seventh season, I think, overall, and I think it's been playing four in the U.S., and some of its beloved characters, Mel and Sue, the kind of host of the thing, and one of the judges, this will be their last season. They're moving from BBC to Channel 4 on Britain. So it's going to change a lot. So that's another reason that this particular episode is special for those who like the show.
Isn't there a finite number of things to bake at the end of at the end of day one? Starts to wonder after so many seasons.
I don't know, Jared.
Well, you would think, but just like we never run out of things to eat that are baked, I suppose.
That's true.
We can also never run out of things to bake.
Have they had the souffle episode? That's always good. Does the souffle collapse in the middle when you take it out, or does it stay popped up to the top? But the souffles are not easy to make.
Yeah, every cartoon at some point or another did the slam door collapse souffle bit.
Exactly.
All right, to sober up for a little bit, what's happening with The Bachelor? This story has gotten really complicated, it seems, and pretty dark that they actually shut down, is it, the filming for Bachelor in Paradise?
Yes, this is a complicated, and of course, The Bachelor franchise has The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, The Bachelor Weddings, Bachelor Pad, all of these things. It's been a huge thing for ABC. And Bachelor in Paradise is where they take people that didn't get picked for the other two franchises and oftentimes deliberately choose the ones that were particularly misbehaving. And they put them in this situation where they're all once again in this environment. And the idea is hopefully they will pair off. But as soon as they arrive, of course, they're given shots of alcohol. So you've got people who are chosen often for their misbehavior. You're lubricating them with lots of alcohol. You're setting up the very kind of environment which ultimately things like what happened, which is apparently two of the contestants or participants, whatever we call them, had sex. There's now an issue of whether they were too drunk for consent, one or both or either of them. And one of the producers made a complaint. The show kept going for another day. Finally, they shut it down. And I think this really makes one question the legitimacy and the ethics of the very premise of this program, which is kind of designed for stuff like this to, if not happen, come pretty close to happening. And the fact that all of this is taking place during and after the Cosby trial, I think, gives it an extra little jolt.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's a very, very, very good point. But as you say, they talk about how they throw all these young people into a beach house to live together for weeks. So, I mean, it does seem like if you're drinking heavily, you're living together in a beach house, you're running around in bathing suits and you're 24 years old, I mean, what do they think is going to happen?
Well, that's true. And of course, we shouldn't say that that means that somehow we can sanction this kind of thing. But you're right. And also, this is not a Sunday school retreat with a bunch of young people in it. They are choosing, in many cases, people who were considered the villains and the misbehaviors. One of the guy involved in this whole thing just got kicked off The Bachelorette. For having already been in a relationship with somebody else and having done all of these sleazy kinds of things. So you cast it to stack the deck for misbehavior. You make alcohol so prevalent and part of it. So it's almost like a chemistry experiment. Let's see if we can make all the elements such that we can make this interesting. And it apparently got too interesting this time. The show was supposed to debut on August 8th. They've already sent everybody home, saying that they might come back, but I cannot possibly imagine that this season is going to be ever completed, or I'm not even sure what the future of the Bachelor in Paradise show should be. It may be gone itself, and I think that would not be a bad thing. By the way, The Bachelorette is still playing. There'll be another episode tonight, and for the first time in all of its 37 seasons, it's got an African-American lead in the Bachelorette. That hasn't happened before.
The Bachelorette is a bunch of women and with one man, is that it? Or is it
backwards? The Bachelorette is one woman with a bunch of men.
Oh, okay.
The Bachelor
okay.
is one man with a bunch of women.
Okay. By
a bunch, they start out now. I think it started the show at 25. Now there's a small village of people.
Do these shows do well in the ratings, Bob?
Yes.
They do.
That's why they keep coming back. And I have to confess, for everything I've just said, and I've talked to you about this before, I still watch these shows. I find them interesting. I find them compelling. I know they're scripted. I know they're fake. I've seen Lifetime's Unreal, which exposes all of this. But they are really kind of interesting. Bachelor in Paradise, I think, by trying to take The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, which is already borderline questionable in its sleaze factor, Bachelor in Paradise simply squares that sleaze factor.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about something a little lighter, which is the return of Mike Myers. Not that we might necessarily know him for what he's doing.
Well, nobody is admitting that Tommy Maitland is Mike Myers.
They're not?
I mean, this is the weird... Okay, so The Gong Show is coming back on... June 22nd on ABC. And as you know, I think The Gong Show was one of television's great masterpieces in its own weird, freaky, Dada sort of way. But so much of that had to do with the fact that it was doing things we hadn't seen before, showing all these bad acts and all the rest of it, and to do with the recently deceased Chuck Barris, who was somebody like we'd never seen before. So I don't have a lot of hopes for this. However, the host is this guy called Tommy Maitland, and he's got his own Twitter account, and nobody is confessing officially that he is Mike Myers. He is Mike Myers, but and that may actually be an element that can bring some new life to this thing that was so wonderful then, but maybe have been of its time. And the judges, they're getting, I think this week's debut is Will Arnett, Kim Jong, and Zach Galifianakis. I think Jack Black and Jennifer Aniston are lined up. So they've got some pretty power hitters in the judge thing. So we'll have to see. I don't have a lot of hopes for this, but it's got some promise.
You know, I don't get it, though, because Mike Myers is such a famous guy. Everybody, he was so funny in Austin Powers. Why this little game about whether it is he or not he?
Well, I think part of it is that it gets people talking about you. Remember Andy Kaufman? One of the great conceptual art comic
yes. Oh, yes.
Right. And he played a character that he then so fell into that it was unclear as to which was the real Andy Kaufman. And that was interesting, and it was fun, and it was creepy, and all of this stuff. I think this Tommy Maitland thing is taking a page from the book of Kaufman.
You know, do you think it's going to – well, I guess you said you didn't have high hopes at the outset, but there was a show here at the Addison Gallery of American Art not too long ago, which was looking back at the birth of television and how it really intersected with some great movements in art, and it got very surrealist, and they were so experimental on television with people like Ernie Kovacs. Do you think they could still do something like that on network television today?
Well, it's possible, and Kovacs is the perfect example. That guy is still way ahead of his time, and he's been dead since 1962. He did some amazing things on television. The Dumont Network, which was trying to compete with the Big Three and did all kinds of live detective shows, if you can believe that. And I think The Gong Show in the 1970s was one of those. It really was... I think something more that belongs in the Museum of Modern Art than it belonged on network television. It's not as though that can't happen again. I think David Letterman did a lot of that in his work in the early 80s, and TV is a place now that doesn't need as big of an audience. Whether it can do it, though, with the reboot of a brilliant show is another thing entirely.
So what to watch this week, Bob Thompson?
Oh, it's going to another Netflix show. They just keep on coming. Friday, the 23rd, Glow. And it's created by the people behind Nurse Jackie. It's executive produced by Jenji Cohen, who did Orange is the New Black. It takes place in 1985, and it's about the origin of the gorgeous ladies of wrestling.
Really?
Critical acclaim is almost universal at this point. It's a half hour long show and looks to be very, very good.
Wow. Now, normally I would not be interested in women wrestling, but why should I be interested in this one?
Well, when one looks at, first of all, the whole wrestling has been on television forever. Very, very earliest days of television, boxing was big and professional wrestling was big, and not Olympic-style professional wrestling, the good old-fashioned, scripted, over-the-top, ridiculous sort of stuff. One of the big stars was a guy named Gorgeous George, a kind of cross-dressing big guy. Before he went into the ring, he had to have perfume sprayed so he didn't smell other people's sweat. He wore a tiara. He had special bobby pins that he called Georgie pins. This was transgressive on so many different levels. And he was operating in the 40s and early 1950s. Then when wrestling really hit it big again in the 1980s, a lot of that stuff was also going on, issues of gender and issues of race and issues of exploitation. And it was kind of right in our face in actual fake wrestling, and now it's in fictionalized actual fake wrestling.
Well, I cannot wait to see this, because in the 1980s, little Jared Bowen was watching wrestling every single week. I could tell you all of the characters. I was so excited when Jesse the Body Ventura was running for governor, and I got to meet him when he was in Minnesota. I mean, yeah.
In that case, you will like this. You remember Mankind, Mick Foley?
Yes, of course.
He was a student of mine when I was teaching at the State University of New York.
Oh, my
and
God.
And when The Rock did on they did their This Is Your Life Mick Foley, they actually got somebody to play Bob Thompson, who both The Rock and Mick Foley then wrestled to the ground.
Oh, my God.
One of my proudest moments of my professional life.
You've been hiding your light under the bushel here, Bob. I'm very impressed.
Well, I don't often tell that story because they called me to actually come there and to play myself. And I had a thing with my daughter, and I wasn't able to do it. And I don't regret that I wasn't able to do it, but I wish I could have actually appeared there in person, especially because future President Dwayne Johnson
That's
was
right.
there.
That's right.
Yes, yeah. Well, I still carry my Andre the Giant wrestling card around in my little planner in my book.
Who knew? Who
there
knew,
you
Jared?
Go.
Thank you very much, Bob Thompson. Great to talk to you as always.
That was fun. Thanks.
Thank you. Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Coming up, the Museum of Fine Arts 2020 Vision. The MFA has a new plan to become more inclusive within the next few years. The MFA's director, Matthew Teitelbaum, joins us for that. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is out for the day. WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen is filling in, and you are listening to Boston Public Radio. So before Matthew Teitelbaum came to Boston to run the Museum of Fine Arts, he was in Toronto as a director and chief executive officer of the Art Gallery of Ontario. Teitelbaum is credited with being one of the visionaries behind the city's cultural revival, and he is poised to do the same thing for Boston by way of the MFA 2020, a three-year strategic plan. He's director of the MFA, joins us here in Studio 3 to go over his vision. Matthew Teitelbaum, so great to see you. Thank you for being here. I was just saying I was over there at the MFA seeing some exhibits, and I'm walking down Huntington Avenue and everybody's hanging out in the front lawn in these Adirondack chairs. It was a pretty cool thing. So welcome. You've got this MFA 2020. What are we basically talking about?
We're talking about a language that describes the kind of MFA we can be, which is a little more welcoming, a little more engaging, content a bit more urgent, and to find the right platform for an extraordinary collection of art that's been put together over generations. So see the world through art, but see it with a sense of the art being tied to the times in which we live.
When you look at the plan and you see some of the programming that started already under your leadership, it sounds like we're looking at a different notion of what a museum is today.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that there are parts of the plan that absolutely build on the past and acknowledge some of the extraordinary work that's been done over, the last generation at the MFA. So there are strands that come forward. There are things that we're doing with a little more depth, and there are some new things. You know, I don't know if it's a revolution in the way that you're describing it. I think of it more of as an evolution, which is to say it's always going to be grounded in the art. It's always going to be grounded in the conviction that art can change the way in which we think about the world. And, you know, it's going to be perhaps more urgently suggested that somehow by convening communities, convening people together in a public space, something new can happen, some new truth can be revealed, again, through the lens of art. So maybe that's a different feeling, but I like to think of it as a continuum of a great institution.
Well, one of the things that I think is new, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the picture on the cover here. We heard about these all-night parties, which I thought was absolutely a brilliant idea, because it's sometimes hard to convince your 21-year-old, I think I read in one of the pieces that a lot of the people that are at the MFA are older, over 45. And here all these young kids, they're not in Adirondack chairs. What are these things that they're sitting in here?
Those are being beanbag chairs.
Tell people about these kind of all-night parties that have gone there. They've been hugely successful, long lines and everything, right?
Okay, one small negotiation. We might not call it a party. We might call it lively experiences with art. You're getting a little defensiveness on my part, so I apologize. But no, we had an extraordinary exhibition last fall, which was The Clock by Christian Markley. It was a 24-hour film, and we wanted people to have the opportunity to see the whole film. How we did that, knowing that only 48 people could come in at a time, and all that logistics aside, we just wanted the concept that you could come to the MFA and see the 24-hour film if you so wished. By the way, I think somebody actually lasted about 10 hours, but no one actually watched the full 24.
Wow.
So we opened for four 24-hour cycles to make sure people had that opportunity. It turns out that we were addressing a real need in our community because we had 7,000 people every night and we had lineups outside. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not so good with lineups. So the fact that people were lined up, and sometimes there were 1,000 people in line outside, and the fact that they were having an experience, sharing thoughts on their iPhones, we were broadcasting on the outside of the building, people felt connected to the inside, but they were essentially waiting to come inside. The fact that they wanted to do that, prepared to do that, tells me pretty strongly that that notion of coming together, sharing experience with art in a social environment where you can convene with one another, talk to one another, make art together. There were huge lineups for life drawing and for collage making. There were live art demonstrations where people could talk to artists and engage. That was what was so exciting for me, was to see that that notion of creativity, the life of the imagination, was really yearned for amongst a cohort of Bostonians. And yes, you're right, it was a not completely younger group, but a skewed younger group. And it was saying there's something about being in this space that's very appealing.
Well, and I guess that's what I was thinking about now I've got my hackles up, when I was describing the notion of a new museum, because I'm sure there are a lot of people listening right now who think of a museum as a place that you go to passively look at pictures. And what you just described is not that place. It's something very different. So how has that played into your vision?
Well, and I think that some of the people who are a little concerned about the directions of the MFA might say, Where's the research agenda? Where's the scholarship? Where is, as you're describing, that quiet moment of solitude? And I would say it's not an either or. I'm saying that the MFA needs to be more of what it is, which is an inviting, welcoming, and engaging place, three key words in our strategic plan, that bring the community in a different way. So you made reference earlier to the Adirondack chairs. You know, it's a pretty cool idea and a simple idea. And what it basically says is the experience of being part of a moment of being with others at the museum begins before you come in the front door. It softens the outside so that when you come in, your way of approaching it may be somewhat different. And by the way, this summer we're going to open up a cafe on the front lawn. We're going to be having the ability for people to actually congregate in a different way. But, you know, I think that the spirit of the MFA will be you can be with others and enjoy and learn. What also comes through, I hope, in the plan is that the way in which we're going to be producing exhibitions and programming will be much more in partnership with others. So that notion of convening, of sharing, of conversation, which is core to my idea of what a museum can be, is going to also begin to be expressed in the way that we develop programs. So when people say to me, you're not pushing scholarship enough, you're not pushing research enough, my response is, we're going to be involved with a lot of leading thinkers in this community and elsewhere. We're going to be convening groups, roundtables, for example, to help us with exhibition development in ways that bring different people's voices inside. So the notion of voice is really important to me because I think a public institution has to be clear that it's inviting many voices in. And I'm saying that particularly at this moment when the question of who owns institutions and what's your access to institutions, I think, is more urgent and more urgent as a question than in recent years. So the notion that we're inviting voices in, both to experience what we're doing and to create what we will present to our audiences, is very important to me. And maybe that is moving the needle a bit more towards revolution and a little away from evolution.
Well, you've mentioned the word urgency a few times. What is the urgency, not even that you're seeing, but that you're feeling right now?
I think we need safe places to have tough conversations. We need safe places to bring us together to engage with different points of view. And, you know, in the core of our collection are different points of view, are different cultures, are different views on the world, different ideas of what God is, different ideas of what the community is, different ideas of what art is. And if we can create a dynamic institution where those art traditions are talking to one another, it'll be exciting for our community, and I think it will be a realistic representation of what goes on in our communities. Then the question is, how do we create the museum as a space where that can happen in a safe way, in a respectful way, in a word that I would use with purpose, in a civilized way?
Are you talking about like people viewing an exhibition and then talking about it at the museum? Because that would be fascinating to me, especially if it's something that's sort of controversial. If people could, I think of the Emmett Till painting at the Whitney that caused a great deal of outrage and consternation. It was the young man's face was slashed over, and there was a lot of African American artists thought it was bad that it was a non African American artist who created it, and so forth and so on. That would have been the kind of thing you could have a great discussion about.
And to the Whitney Museum's credit, they created terrific public forums for just those discussions in the space itself. And I think that's very, very important. Well, I'll give you an outcome I'd love that is hard to measure, which is I've always thought a test of whether or not a museum is doing its work is whether or not the subject that it presents to the public, the experience it presents to the public, becomes dinner time conversation on a Sunday night. And if that starts to happen, where multi-generational families, where friends who happen to go to the museum together continue their discussion outside the walls of the museum and take the issues that we've raised back home or wherever and sit around a table sharing those thoughts long after they've left the museum, that means we're having an impact. And I think that, yes, the notion of conversation is very important to me.
Jumping off Marjorie's point, it seems like every week now there is an art story that's drawing controversy and it has political ramifications, from the Dana Schutz painting of Emmett Till that Marjorie mentioned to Sam Durant in Minnesota making a sculpture of scaffolding talking about injustice in America, but that was grossly offensive to Native Americans. They took that down. Last week we were reading about Julius Caesar, that production which features a very Donald Trumpian Julius Caesar as its central character at the Shakespeare in the Park in New York. That's still going on, but it's drawn a huge backlash. Is that now suddenly part of your job title? I mean, do you expect that that's going to, that this is a the new normal, essentially?
Well, I think we all have to be thoughtful and reflective about the context in which we show things, the ways in which they'll be received. That's one of the reasons why I'm really interested in the notion of convening and roundtable conversations in advance of creating a program, because you can create advocates on one hand, but even before you create advocates, you can surface what some of the issues are. You can understand more clearly. And, you know, we do live in a moment when there's so many things coming at us that it's not more difficult to understand, but we are accounting for more and more in this regard. So I do think that it is challenging. But, you know, I also reflect that the only response to challenging times, and I say that apolitically, just a context in which every day we read something which challenges certain assumptions we have, is not to simply be interested in the big P political. It's also to create a space where people can understand that art as an experience is its own recipe for rethinking issues. So, you know, this early fall, we're opening up a room of Mark Rothko paintings, you know, completely deep contemplative, deeply, you know, a space of reflection. That's actually in our title, the notion that reflection is a valuable thing. So I don't think that the response to this moment or any has to be, we will create and show art that is provocative, that is divisive, that raises issues. It is a moment also for public institutions to encourage thinking about how art can change the way we think.
For some reason, a number of people over the last week, I would say, have asked me if I know anything about attendance numbers recently for institutions. And I think they're looking at all sectors of the arts, whether it's symphony, theater, or your museum. And if you're finding right now in this political climate where a lot of people are talking about stress and overeating and not sleeping, are you finding higher attendance at the museum right now?
We are doing very well at the moment. I can't say that it's because people are stressed or that they're looking to us for something very, very specific. I would like to say it's because of what we've done and we've hit the moment. I mean, we have hit a moment between Matisse and Botticelli and this extraordinary exhibition on Lodge ghetto photographs. There are different recipes for thinking about what art can mean in this moment, and the work is of a stature that is drawing it very well.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. We're talking to Matthew Teitelbaum. He's the director of the MFA. You know what I think, because everyone loves something for free, that you are this idea of free memberships to college and faculty and new citizens to the United States. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, the question is, if you think about invitation, welcome, engagement as the three steps of a museum experience, which I do. How do you invite somebody? How do you say, please come? And then the welcome is, come in my building, how do you feel? And the engagement is, what are you getting out of the art experience? Often the admission price is an impediment. It isn't always an impediment. Our hours of operation are, the way we look when you come in the front door may be an impediment, but price is an impediment for some. So these are two programs. One we had existing, which was outreach to universities and community colleges. We're deepening that program because we're saying you belong here. In the end, I think that if you try to find a phrase out of the strategic plan that maybe pushes an assumption in a very positive direction and quite boldly, it is you belong here. And so a lot of what you see in the plan comes under that umbrella. So the free access for community and university students is that notion that, you know, if we take away that and therefore you can come with your friends more easily on a Saturday afternoon, then you'll begin to think this is your place. Now, that's even more powerfully expressed in MFA Citizens, which is a program to give free membership to all naturalized Americans living in the state of Massachusetts. So when you think about the notion of accepting America as your country and America accepting you, you're actually dealing with the concept of home, which is, this is my new home. We want you to come into our home. And I think that's not a bad way to think about a museum, right? Which is, the museum should have attributes of home. It is a big institution. Believe me, the MFA is a really big institution. I mean, it rivals the Supreme Court for the austerity of its building. But in any event, you know, it is an institution. But if it's going to succeed, it's going to be because it combines the power of the institution with the feeling of home, which is all those attributes of warmth, welcome, you know, hands around you when you come in. And again, if we can say to new Americans, you belong here, and the proof of that is we want you to be a member here, and we're going to give you tours in your language, we're going to give you care, you know, packages of information to take away with you, I think we're doing the right thing.
And what about what they see? One of the tenets of your vision, too, is to collect purposefully. And you talk about, you highlight the Frida Kahlo painting that was recently acquired, the first painting by that Mexican artist in any museum in New England. Is there going to be a deliberate shift in how you acquire at this point to reflect more people, more voices, more viewpoints?
You know, we're still working that out in one sense, which is that the precise nature of the strategy, we need more conversation, because what's really important to me is the notion that we acquired a level that truly is both an achievement in reflecting where the arts come from, but also part of a narrative of the history of art. And I'm big on that. And that's why the Frida Kahlo painting was so terrific. What I think you can look for at the MFA over the next number of years is that we will become increasingly purposeful and much more evident in how we create stories and narratives. That when you walk into a room, there will be it'll be a short story. It'll be a way to talk about the narrative and the story that we want to share, that we want to engage you with. And I think we're going to be much more purposeful about that. You could think about the MFA as a series of short stories.
You know, Matthew Teitelbaum, you've mentioned a couple of times, I think, that the entrance to the museum is a little foreboding. I don't know if I'm putting words in your
mouth.
Don't
you think so?
Well,
what do you think?
Well, you know, it's got the big, huge steps, and you come into that open hallway. I, of course, am very partial to the gift store, which is right on the left. I bought a lot of great jewelry at that gift store.
And we are glad you did.
Well, you know what the great thing is? If you have no taste, and I don't really have any taste, you figure this is created by an artist. It's in the MFA gift store. I can't go wrong.
The work
has been done.
But
since you're a member, you get a discount. So it's all virtuous, isn't it?
You can get a discount. I have let my membership lapse. I should get back in my membership.
Well, only until tomorrow morning.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you. But in any case, what are you talking about doing to the entrance? Are you talking about changing it so that it looks different? Or what are you talking about?
Okay, so I want to say again, I think one of the great things about the MFA is it is an institution. It's got depth. It's been here for 150 years. Like, it is who we are.
Yes.
But you do want to soften it. You do want to make people feel that when they walk up the steps and they walk through those big doors, there's going to be some sort of feeling of, hey, we're glad you're here. So, you know, we're not doing anything architectural, right? We're going to do something on the front lawn. We're going to soften that sense of how you enter what we call the threshold space.
Yep.
When you walk in, both entrances, whether it's the Fenway side or the Huntington side, we're going to try and soften it a bit. Maybe the sculptures are all a little foreboding, a little overwhelming.
Okay.
Find a way to, we're not going to have little things that reach out and massage your neck, you know, but we're going to do something.
Well, why not? I mean, right. that's an idea. We're all a little nervous these days. Got a little 10 minutes.
Well, when our membership numbers go up, we'll have the funds to do that. So you could sort of help us in that direction.
Okay.
But, you know, something that just says, come on in. And that has to do with the art program. It has to do with the seating. It has to do with, well, I don't know. We have some other thoughts and we're going to work on them. So just so you have a sense of, let's just call it a softer entrance.
Talking about funding, you authored a letter with a number of other local museum directors about the threatened cuts to the National Endowment for the Arts. What if that does happen, and there is a lot of conversation, people are scared that that's going to happen to the arts community, what would be the impact at the MFA?
Well, I think there are 3 or 4 or 10 impacts, right? The short-term impact is that we'll lose some funding. And we do get funding each year to do something, whether it's a community-based initiative, whether it's a particular publication program. It's something in service of the public. Okay, so everything that we do with funds from either the NEA or the NEH has a public manifestation. So there'll be that effect. Then there will be the effect on what I call what we can think of as the ecology of the cultural community, which is, I'm not thinking about Boston, New York, Los Angeles, although I am. I'm thinking about the small place, the theater company in Grand Rapids, or the, you know, the art space in Bentonville, or I'm thinking about something that's happening in a small community that really depends on NEA, NEH funding to bring communities together to celebrate the role of the imagination. Those institutions, many of those institutions may cease to exist. I mean, I'm not being alarmist. I'm just saying the economics of it suggest that some institutions will not survive. And then I worry about the people in those communities, particularly the young aspiring artists, the students, who are just not going to have that opportunity. So there's this ecology of connection that comes from that, and I worry that that's going to be lost. And then, I guess, thirdly, I would say, why don't we live in a country that celebrates the life of the imagination and the life of artists? Like, why don't we live in that country, and how can we strengthen it as opposed to weaken it? And I think a lot about that.
Thank you very much for coming in. It's wonderful to talk to you. I'm very much looking forward to the little cafe in the front lawn.
I will look for you.
Okay, I'll wave as I come up.
Please do.
As you're getting your massage.
That's right.
All right, Matthew Teitelbaum is the director of the Museum of Fine Arts. To learn more about the MFA and upcoming exhibits, go to mfa.org. Matthew Teitelbaum, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Coming up, the Pope's ultimatum to the Mafia. It's either the Catholic Church or La Cosa Nostra. Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us for that and more on All Revved Up. They're next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is off. WGBH Arts Editor, Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen is here. And we are here, as we are every week, with our Reverends Emmett Price and Irene Monroe. And that's the outro, not the intro. I'm on the wrong page. Turn back the page.
It's still us, though.
We're still here.
Yes. And Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, and Emmett is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene and Emmett, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us back.
Oh, my goodness. There's Bill Cosby, the whole family, on the cover of Ebony magazine. Well,
that's right, because I refuse to get rid of this piece here and stuff, because it reminds me of a time when he was very, very, you know, iconic in our culture.
Well, that's where we wanted to start, because, you know, I can see this in two, where a lot of people have written. There's been a lot of great pieces by African Americans saying, you know, he was not. Don't make him out to be this big hero in the black culture, because he wasn't. But he did make inroads into the white culture. And I remember, this is terrible to say, I have to bless myself, because my father's been dead for years and years and years, and he would be well over 100 if he were alive today. But he was not the most progressive man when it came to race relations. And I remember when he had Bill Cosby was on I Spy, mm-hmm. and suddenly this was a black guy he really thought was great and he really laughed at. And I was kind of surprised him, because, like I say, I hate to speak ill of my father, because he was a great guy in many ways, but he was not a very progressive guy mm-hmm. on race relations. So there's a twofold, there's one role for him in black America and one role for him in white America.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the conundrum, right? So Bill Cosby was a path, you know, he was a trailblazer. He was one of very few individuals who were African-American at the time who was able to permeate the media and have this very respectable role where he didn't have to be a butler. He didn't have to be, you know, something that was diminished in capacity. The problem is that was then and this is now. And so as much as Irene is a hoarder and continues to have this magazine from, what, 1984? I mean,
no,
what are you talking about?
It's June 2015. With
what year?
It's November, June 2015.
And the shattered glass, right?
That's
on
right.
The ebony,
on the
right,
ebony cup. That's right.
Issues.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we should
clarify. So we're looking at that cover. We're looking at the Huxtable family.
That's right.
Loved them from the 1980s.
That's right. And we always got to make the distinction between what I say, you know, Dr. Huxtable and Mr. Hyde here. So I'm not of two minds. I'm of really one mind. One of which is that this morning I got up and watched an episode of Bill Cosby because it is on
the Black Cable.
Wait a minute. It's on the Black Cable Network, TV One, because it was thrown off TV Land. And so what I say is that we really got to make a distinction between the man and his body of work. And I feel that if we can do this with Woody Allen and Roman Polanski, I can't see why we cannot do that with Bill Cosby. But I do want to say this about Bill Cosby, and this is a cautionary note to white America, that when white America choose what we perceive to be safe black people, you get an OJ who is definitely a murderer, and you get a Bill Cosby who is a serial rapist. And so to resonate with Emmett just on this, you're absolutely right here about that. But he represents, I think it's important to understand the context in terms of his body of work and not the man. It's 1980s. We have the crack cocaine. Reagan is president. We also have the AIDS epidemic, although it wasn't surfacing as, you know, prominently as it certainly is now in the African-American community. I agree. 30 minutes of a sitcom cannot remove us from the reality of what was going in 1980. But it's not to negate the body of work and showcasing black America beyond the stereotype of being a deprived, you know, community. There are two things that's operating. White America as well as black America got educated about black art, black music, black educators. Alvin Poussant was on the show. And you got to understand this. Bill Cosby is of that era of John Johnson, who was the editor of Ebony Magazine, which is to show another side of black America.
Okay, we got to move Irene off the milk crate.
Okay.
Because, again, what I said was that was then,
yeah,
and this is now.
And I Spy, by the way, was really early. Yeah, 1970. That was...
I know, but are you going to negate that, though? Because we couldn't get to now were it not for then.
But the people who were on the planet now... who watched that then have already been formalized. They're adults. You've already made decisions on who you are, what you're going to be. The people who were trying to influence now are the same people who Cosby was trying to influence then, who are the young people, the adolescents, the people in their 20s and perhaps early 30s. Those people are grown now, and the people who are in their teens and 20s and 30s don't watch anything from that era.
But the point is that you cannot negate the milestones that were made because of the kind of portrayal, the Bill Cosby. We would not
Let's
have
talk about
an African. Okay, listen. Wait, hold up now.
Douglas
we would not have
person.
An African American president.
That was then.
Then, as if then doesn't have any relevancy for what is here today.
So, I want to be clear about where you guys are coming from. You're saying we should be able to look at his TV shows and still laugh like we could before we knew what was going on in his private life? Because I think
I look at it with like, what a shame.
Yeah.
But it's not. But no more what a shame than looking at Woody Allen's material or Roman Polanski.
But I can't look at Woody Allen and Roman Polanski.
But that's the point. But a lot of people can.
Yeah.
I do say this, that in 1992, and you remember this book here. It said Enlightened Racism: The Cosby Show, Audience, and the Myth of American Dream. You know, the show represented the successfulness of the black middle class. It really did. It distorted America's perception about African-American progress. I'll give you that. It allowed whites to feel a sense of self-satisfaction about race relationships without having to do anything. But let's not negate this, that we were fighting also. Bill Cosby is talking about what still hovers today. Daniel Moynihan's notorious report on the African-American family called The Myth of the Black Matriarch.
20-something years
so
ago.
Hold on. Irene, give him a chance. So, you are saying what?
I'm saying that there are shows on TV like Blackish now
that
are relevant to what people are doing today, that have a perspective and a representation of black life today that dispels the notion of cultures. What do we call it? Cultures of you know, all black people, middle class, dress up. Everybody goes to college. These are respectable black people, you know. And so we have shows now that kind of show the diversity of blackness, that we don't have to look back 20, 30 years ago to see a model. There are shows on TV right now.
Yeah, but those shows, but that's not fair. Those shows exist because of Bill Cosby Show. Let me just say this. Bill Cosby Show had a spinoff called A Different World.
Yeah.
And there was data to prove that because of that show, Bill Cosby and its spinoff, many more African-American kids not only perceived that they could go, went to college, and went to historically black colleges.
The point is that the original question is Bill Cosby relevant or relevant today?
Well,
and I'm saying that he's irrelevant today.
That's disrespectful of your elders.
Hold on for a second. One thing he was doing, though, which I would find very annoying, remember he's lecturing everybody about pulling up their pants and the pound cake story where he seemed to be...
The cheesecake, yeah.
Was it cheesecake or pound cake, whatever the heck it was. I mean, explain that, because that was really a little obnoxious.
That's when he lost a huge population of African Americans, including myself, because he really created this disparity between those who had and who could reflect back and say that if y'all just live like me and do what I did, then you would become something of yourselves.
Oh, that is just that is totally simplistic, and that's a broad, that's just broad strokes. He was talking about self-reliance. You got to understand that Bill Cosby really is maintaining the gains of the civil rights movement and moving us forward. So if you're going to critique that, then you need to critique how successful the civil rights movement allowed someone like us, the beneficiary of Brown versus Board of Education, to go to the elite schools that we've gone to.
Okay, go ahead.
You
go
show
ahead.
No respect for your elders.
I'll show you this. So I agree with the benefits of the civil rights movement. One of the challenges of the civil rights movement is where people were fighting in the civil rights movement, people were not coming home debriefing their children on why they were fighting. So when I was coming along in the 90s, we wore African medallions, we wore dashikis, we wore natural hair, had no connectivity why we did it. We did it because we were trying to be like the Irene Monroes, and we were trying to be like the Malcolm X's, we were trying to be like the Martin Kings, but we didn't have the esprit de corps. And so part of what happens in hip hop culture is that we move from a sensational perspective of this kind of black, you know, camaraderie and this black liberation piece, but we don't have the gravitas of the folks who had in the 40s and the 60s.
Are you blaming black parenting, those of us who benefit from the civil rights? Are you blaming me for not parenting well?
No, I'm saying that you guys were so busy fighting that there was no debriefing. So there is a dynamic tension between generations, as you can reveal here.
Well, Bill Cosby is a dirty old man. I need to say that much.
I think everything has changed now.
You know, we're not going to get to all the other stuff we're going to talk about, but before we move on from this, why do you think he had a hung jury?
I think huge celebrityhood. From what I understand, the way that the laws are written, a number of the juries had a very difficult time parsing what their responsibility and their role was and what they were saying yes to and what they were saying no to. And I think that's a huge challenge in juries, you know, from Bill Cosby to Philando Castile's murderer's jury to a number of other folks, that when you get in the jury box, you don't necessarily know what you're saying yes to and no to
because of the fine line in the law. No, I disagree with that. I think it has a lot to do with the whole the not understanding rape culture, what it means when a woman says no. I think that what happens here is that this man has money. He has great lawyers, and he's also a celebrity. And I think that what we have here is that when we talk about rape, we have evolved, believe it or not, we have evolved much further than we have ever on this issue. But we still don't understand that, because what they don't understand and they're confused about is that after that incident happened, they were able to record 72 times in which they had exchanged either emails or conversations. What is the confounding factor of that is that they forget forget that Constance was still working at Temple University. So she was doing her job. A lot of those encounters, it's sort of like with Anita Hill. Many people ask, well, if Clarence was this horrible, how come you continued to be in dialogue? Because she worked for the fool. So the point is that they see those encounters, those telephone calls, as that must be a hookup.
But you're parsing You're parsing the incidences and the situations and the circumstances. The jury has to parse the law. They have to parse what these five sentences say, that they either say, yes, this was proven beyond a reasonable doubt, or
well,
no, this
see,
was proven.
Now, see,
and that's a distinction there.
Okay, you're absolutely right, but it's absolutely you begin to see the gender and racial bias in the law here and stuff. And what they're trying to do is that the statute of limitations on these rape cases, they're trying to. And I think that Brown did this in California. He just left them because they're finding out through evidence that it takes a while for a woman to even talk about it. And so the statute of limitation limits their ability that when they're ready to come forth to give their case. They're going to get a verdict the next time simply because they're going to call more of the women who have been victims of his rape.
You know, we had about five other things we were going to talk about.
I'm sorry.
But it's okay. No, because it was very fascinating.
You talk about my bill, I have to defend.
Irene was passionate today.
That's right. She was very passionate. Right. Well, she's passionate every day.
I had to bring in my Ebony magazine, okay, and for Emma to remember, okay, what we have put in place for
hoarder.
His generation.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the only segment where I've never said a word.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Right.
I felt like I was the referee, you know, back and forth. But you guys, it was great, though. Thank you.
Thanks for having us back.
Yeah, thank you very much. Love to have you guys, as always.
Reverend Irene Moreau and Emmett Price.
Thank you for showing us Ebony Magazine.
They join us every week for All Revved Up. Irene Moreau is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett Price is a professor of worship, church, and culture, and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you, with the tall ships in town, do you do like the tourists do, or are you one of those people who has lived here for years and has never taken advantage of our main attractions? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy is off. Jared Bowen is in. So it's high tourism time in Massachusetts, from the tall ships to the 4th of July fireworks to summer vacations on the Cape and the islands, with thousands of outsiders descending on the Bay State to take in historic sites. We're opening the lines and asking you if you're guilty of a different kind of NIMBYism, and I certainly am, not investigating our own backyards. The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Have you ever taken a duck boat tour? Have you been to the JFK Library? Have you walked the Freedom Trail? Or are you someone who figures, since you live here, what is the rush? You don't feel the twinges of guilt when you see the tourists are taking the time to learn more about your hometown than you do? Or do you feel bad, you know, when your college roommate and family shows up from, like, Minnesota and they've seen all these things in 3 days in Boston that you've never seen and you've lived here your entire life? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. I haven't seen half of these things.
I have seen a lot, I have to say. So we're talking about, there was a piece in the Boston Globe. I move in a month, but first I tackle my Boston bucket list. And there's this extraordinary list of, there are actually a lot of things to do in this city. And I think partly because of my job, I've just naturally been to a lot of the museums, performances, etc. But I'm surprised, Marjorie, because you and I both were born here. We grew up here. I went to college here. I escaped for a while, but came back and managed to do most of this stuff,
okay,
including the duck tour, including the swan boats.
Well, I've done the duck tour. Well, a lot of the stuff I've done with my kids. You know, you had to go on the duck tour with the kids and all that. But have you ever sailed on the Charles River?
That is one I did not. I have not done.
I have not done that. Now, I do know how to sail. I've driven by up Storrow Drive, down Memorial Drive for years. Ever since, I remember my oldest kid, who's 30 now, was in daycare over in Cambridge. I drive down Storrow Drive. In the summertime, you're stuck in traffic. What are you doing? You're looking at the people sailing and thinking, how cool is that? Really hot July night to be out there, 6:30, sailing around. I have never, ever, ever done it. Have you gone on a Boston ghost tour?
I don't know how you're doing this, but you're picking all of the things that I have not done.
I haven't done that. I haven't done that either. I've never even heard of the chocolate mousse at L.A. Burdick. Have you?
Well, I have had the hot chocolate at L.A. Burdick.
Okay.
Does that
well,
count?
You're doing pretty well. Now, I have been to the Arnold Arboretum.
I have been there.
The Public Garden. Of
yep.
course, we've all been there.
Yep.
But you know where I've only been once in my whole life? The Boston Athenaeum.
Really?
Yes. And that is a spectacular place. And I hear it's been kind of redone.
It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. Including the Book of Human Skin that's at the Boston Athenaeum. Yep.
Are those the dead bodies that they cover them with skin?
One book they have that was in, covered in human skin.
Yeah. Well, okay.
It's part of the Notorious Holdings, and I should say the rest of the holdings are pretty spectacular, including, I believe, it's part of George Washington's library, and it's a gorgeous space.
Okay. Well, I should go there. But here's one. Now, I've been here a lot. Castle Island. You've been to Castle Island?
I have been. I used to run there. Okay. I haven't had the hot dog there, which is part of the bucket list experience.
Yeah, at Sullivan's. The chili dog and the cheeseburgers there are pretty good, too. So there's a whole list of these great things that people... You know what I've never done? I've never been to the Cheers bar.
I was just going to ask you.
Never.
I've done that.
Never?
I did that once to kill time.
How was it?
It was uneventful. Nobody knew my name. George Wendt was not there. Neither was Woody Harrelson.
I mean, I have probably walked by the Cheers bar 200 times. Have I ever gone in there and had a drink?
See,
not
see what you
once.
Could do? You could go, you could do your community boating on the Charles and
yeah.
then have it, or you could, to make sure you're more nimble, you could have your drink and then go do your community boating on the Charles.
That's right.
That would be helpful.
That's right. So what have you guys failed to do? What's on your bucket list of things? I did go see the Tall Ships on Saturday, actually. And, saw a few and okay, I've seen them. That's it. And you know, I think a lot of people were scared away from the Tall Ships because the publicity made it sound like it was going to be an absolute, total, and complete mob scene. And I guess it was good on the ships, but it wasn't that hard to actually go see them.
I saw one Tall Ship because I was flying in yesterday and it was we flew over the harbor. So I saw one little lonely Tall Ship out there. But I had been doing the touristy thing in Dallas. And and it's funny because I was, well, it, not funny, but one of the things I did was going to the book depository and seeing that whole site.
JFK.
Which I have to say, if you go, it's such an impactful experience and it's very intense and it certainly makes you understand what happened and just breaks your heart for the way it happened. But I'm there and I'm thinking all these people are driving by as some of the idiots. They have marked the two spots in the road where the shots were landed and hit the president. And these idiots are out there taking their pictures on the X's in the road, which is actually leading to a highway. Just morons. So then you think, well, this is why you don't want to be a tourist in your own town, because you know that everybody's looking at you with disdain.
Yeah, but it is true, isn't it? You go someplace else and you immediately, like I went to Memphis, and what did I do? I went to Graceland to see where Elvis Presley lived. I have friends in Memphis who have never been to Graceland. They just like, oh, you know, it's nothing, it's just not even a spectacular house. I'd never even been. 877-301-8970. What are you guys up to? Are you seeing the things in Boston? Do you have a bucket list of things you need to see? We have a quite extensive list of this bucket list. Who wrote this piece? I've lost the title of it. Whoever
it
wrote
was
the
written
piece.
By Rachel Razka.
Yeah, thank you. She's got a long bucket list, and we'll tell you if
I have regrets, by the way. I never went to Lockover to eat there.
Oh, I did that.
I never went to Anthony's Pier 4
oh, I did that.
To eat there.
Yeah, Lockover was pretty cool. There used to be all men's dining rooms in there, and you were only allowed into certain sections. And the thing about Anthony's Pier 4 is you could sit out and look at the harbor, which was absolutely beautiful. Anyway, let's go to the calls. Julia in Arlington. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, have you done all the touristy stuff or not? You're in Arlington there.
I've done a lot of it, and I do as much as I can. I get museum subscriptions, and we really enjoy it. It's the whole reason to live here. It's easy to do that stuff. It's really accessible, and you shouldn't miss it.
Well, aren't you a good Bostonian, even though you live in Arlington? Okay, so is there anything you've missed? Have you been to the South Street Diner at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Well, does 2 o'clock count?
2
wow.
o'clock. You are impressive. I thought I was going to catch you on that one. If people haven't
that
seen
was
that,
like 20 years ago.
Okay, that's the one down by the South Station, by the train on the bus station.
It's worth. You got to go.
It is a great place.
20 years ago counts. A lot of the things that I did 20 years ago too.
Thank you very much for the call, Julia. Okay, have you been to the Mount Auburn Cemetery?
I have because I did a story there.
That is a really cool place. If you've not been there before, I have only been there once, and it was last year. And I went to go see where the woman that founded Christian Scientist, Mary Baker Eddy, her enormous tomb
Have you been to the Maparium at the Christian Science Center?
No, I have not.
I have.
Tell people what that is.
That is a room full of maps, and you can whisper, and it echoes throughout the whole space.
If you whisper on one side of the room, you can hear it on the other side of the room, right?
I will tell you, this is so immodest of me to tell you this, but I remember walking in and getting recognized, and because it was loud, it was a little bit traumatic because everybody spun around and looked at me.
Oh, there's Jared Bowen! There's Jared Bowen!
Which is the only time that's ever happened to me.
I don't believe that. Let's go to Wanda in Fall River. Hi, Wanda.
It's Rhonda. But
oh,
that's
sorry.
Okay with an R.
Sorry.
I'm a longtime listener and first time caller. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
So, you're welcome. So, I lived and worked in Boston. I'm on the South Coast now, but I find that I never go to any of those places because largely parking is a problem, traffic is a problem, and I know I sound like the Grinch, but. I think that's a big part of it. And when I do go, and I've done the duck boat tour, it was because a friend of mine was coming in from London with her kid, and I had to find something for us to do, so then I did it. But otherwise, I don't think we take advantage enough, and I think a lot of the problem is, like, for instance, the tall ships. It's like they're talking about 2 million people over the course of a week.
I know.
And all I can see is traffic nightmare.
Exactly.
You know? And with all the security, you know, I don't know. I guess.
So, Rhonda, do you live in Fall River now?
I do.
Have you been on the battleship Massachusetts?
You know, recently, and it was on business.
Okay.
And that's the funny thing. I travel a lot for work, so I'm in every major market once a week. I'm in a major market somewhere other than New England.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I don't take advantage of those opportunities, too. I go to Nashville. I don't go see Graceland. I go wherever I go, I don't do it. The only one I did do was Dallas when I did the JFK tour of where his the route that he drove and then the building where the guy shot him from.
Yep.
So I did that, and that was sobering, and it left me feeling a little sad for a couple of days. But
well, Rhonda, thank you very much for that call. The battleship Massachusetts, people don't know, is this big, huge battleship, of course. It's down on the Fall River. I remember we were collecting money to get that to come to Fall River when we were little. That was kind of like a big tourist attraction down there. That, of course, and the other famous thing is Lizzie Borden's house, the place she gave her father 40 wax. And when she saw what she had done, she gave her mother 41. My aunt used to live in the house she moved to after the murders.
Really?
You know, you spent my childhood running around looking for the axe. It was very, very exciting.
You didn't find it?
We did not find the axe. No, we didn't. But I think she absolutely did it.
All right, let's go to Mark calling from the car. Hi, Mark.
Hey, I got a great story. So we were going to go on vacation. We got to the airport. There was supposed to be a 7 o'clock flight in the morning. Got there at like 5 in the morning, gave them our bags, got up to the gate. They said, no, this is 7 o'clock at night.
Ah!
Ouch.
So we're at the airport. Now what are we going to do? So we said, you know what? We did a one-day staycation in Boston. We took the Silver Line. I had never taken the Silver Line before. We took that to South Station. We hopped on the Red Line or took that somewhere. We did a tour of Fenway Park. We went and had lunch at that Red Sox bar on Boylston Street. What's it called? McGreevy's, I think. We'd
I
always
know.
Wanted to go in there. There's
I
a ton of Red Sox history in there. We did the duck boat tour. We did all kinds of stuff in the city in one day that we had never done before.
That is hilarious. So, that's a lot of stuff.
That's pretty impressive. You really packed it in. You made it back in time for your flight, I take it.
Yeah, and my wife didn't kill me.
That's a good one. Thank you very much for the call, Mark.
Mark reminds me of something I've not done. I've not done the tour that takes you behind the Green Monster and to see the scoreboard. I've not
Neither
done that.
Neither have I.
Nope.
Neither have I. Have you been to the Hayden Planetarium at the Science Museum?
I have for a school field trip.
Yeah. Yeah, so did I when I was a kid. How about see a science theater production at the MIT Museum?
I have not done that.
Neither have I. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. Stand under the old State House balcony. Download a reading of the Declaration of Independence while you're there from Audible or something. I don't even know there's anything neat about the old State House balcony being underneath it.
We just talked about this the other day, remember?
Yeah, where stuff was falling out of the ceiling on people.
No, the old State House where I was talking about that show Blood on the Snow. That happened at the old
yes.
State House.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's
yeah,
right.
So there's a great reason to go there.
Okay.
Add that to your bucket list.
877-301-8970. I've not taken a taco tour through East Boston. Have you?
Nope. Have you been to Bartleby's Burgers?
Oh, in Harvard Square.
Yeah, I've never been.
I was there a million years ago.
Mr. Bartley's.
Yeah, that's where they have all the Jim Browdy, I think, claims he has a burger named after him there, but I don't believe that's true. What have you done in Boston that you thought was wonderful? What is on your Boston bucket list? Nina from Canton, hi.
Hi. I actually really want to go to the Cape Cod location where the JFKs like spent their summers. I've grown up always going to Craigville Beach, which is really close.
Oh, yeah.
But never actually been down there. And then the place that I have been to and I really enjoyed was the Boston Symphony for the first time.
Oh,
that was amazing.
That was
and
great.
And I actually, people thought that I looked like one of the main performers, so they sent me downstairs.
Really?
And I asked to go to the restroom, and I have photos with the cast that was performing. That it was the most amazing experience.
Who did they think you were?
It's this woman named Allison. I have her on Facebook now. She's a performer, and she sings opera, which I cannot do.
Okay.
But we do have a very keen resemblance to each other. So,
Nina, have you been to the JFK Library in Dorchester?
I have, and I just actually visited my friend who works at the Boston Globe as they're closing up. So I did just get to see the Globe before it moved. So.
Yeah, that's pretty neat, too, because, Nina, thank you for the call. That's going to be depressing because you can see all the presses when you drive down Morrissey Boulevard, those big, huge yellow presses. And one of the neatest things in the world is seeing those presses running when they're putting out the paper at midnight. That's going to be gone. And the Globe is going to be moving downtown.
There'll be no more. Have you been to see another one? Nina just reminded me that I've never been to the JFK birthplace in Brookline. Have you?
Yes, I have. On Beale Street in Brookline. Yeah, that's pretty neat. And they all had the children at home in those days. So Rose Kennedy was giving birth in those bedrooms. But I suppose after you have, when you're up to number 8 or 9, it doesn't take you very long to have a baby. So maybe it wasn't so arduous. But I can't imagine having your first baby at home in your bedroom. Ayaz, is it Ayaz from Worcester?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Thank you for calling. What's your bucket list?
Thank you. My bucket list is I really want to go see where the Tea Party occurred in Boston, the harbor, and check out to have a nice lobster at Cape Cod. Those are the two things I want.
Yeah, I've never been to the Tea Party. Have you been to the Tea Party site? That's a good one.
Again,
I don't
on
even
a
know where
trip.
It was. Where do they throw the tea over? Where do they throw the tea over water?
It's down by the Children's Museum.
Oh, by the Children's Museum. Yeah. Okay. Well, I know where that is. Okay. That's a good one. And you got to have a lobster on Cape Cod. Although, you know what's weird about the Cape? You think that, why is there no, like, legal seafoods on Cape Cod? What is a classic seafood restaurant on Cape Cod? A lot of, like, places in Hyannis and fish and chips and stuff like that. But you don't think of the classic Cape Cod seafood restaurant, do you?
Well, it's because it's all about going to the mom and pop, isn't it?
I guess maybe that's it. Our number is 8. Oh, we're almost out. We are out of time. I'm sorry. We didn't get to everybody in the phones, but we are out of time. Jared Bowen, thank you very much for coming in today. I think I'm inspired now to go back to the Athenaeum.
So instead of checking off another one, you're just going to go back to the one that you've already been
well,
to.
I've been there in such a long time, and besides, they've redone it, so I hear it's very hip and trendy now, and I try to be hip and trendy, as hip and trendy as I can be every day.
All right, I'm going to go to the JFK house, and I'm going to get a burger at Mr. Bartley's. That's going to be my...
It's supposed to be nice and greasy.
And I'll look and see if Jim has a burger there.
He says he does. I don't believe it.
All right, well, thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for actors Lindsay Krause and Brad Hall. They're in a production of The Effect, now playing at Gloucester Stage Company. Andrea Cabral is also with us, along with Nancy Kane and Sue O'Connell. Our crew is Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tereskes, Molly Boygon, Christina Binet. Our engineer is John LeClaw Parker. We're a production of WGBH.
I would normally at this point ask Jim Brady what's on television tonight, but he's not here, so I don't have to ask him. And I can ask you on Friday what's coming on Open Studio. Unless you know right now and you want to promote it all week long.
I would love to promote it. We actually have put together an itinerary for you, speaking of bucket list items, of all the great museum exhibitions that you can see right now.
That's excellent.
Yes.
Okay. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jared Bowen.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.